welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this ongoing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility on this Tuesday. It is the 11th day of March in the year 2014, and I'm saying that basically in case people pick up an archived copy of the program today. And it is a pleasure to be with you, and I really mean that. It is the second day in our week, and I look forward to spending some time with you, and I look forward to hearing from some of you. We spent a little bit of time yesterday on foreign policy. I want to spend a little bit more. There are a lot of issues. I'm collecting and accumulating quite a pile of issues once we get off this, but I don't want to get off it until we finish it, if that makes sense. Bob and I were talking about a speech that Dianne Feinstein, for of the United States Senate today, that is really getting some attention in the media. I looked at the Washington Post and the New York Times about an hour ago, and the fact that she has been such a supporter of America's foreign policy initiatives. She's been a big supporter of spying. She's been a big supporter of the CIA. She's been a defender of the NSA program. And has talked about the need in today's world for having an effective foreign policy and spying apparatus and all the rest of it. So the fact that she would give the speech that she did on the floor of the United States Senate today is pretty important. And it's going to be interesting to see how President Obama responds, because very honestly, Dianne Feinstein is one of his biggest supporters in the United States Senate. There are a number of other members of the Senate who have had serious questions about some of the things we're doing, the use of drones and many of other things. And one of his pretty much loyal supporters has been Dianne Feinstein. So anyway, the speech that she gave today, which is a release of some secret documents about some of the interrogation practices engaged in by the CIA, which she blatantly called torture today, and the fact that the CIA is in part sitting on the Senate's report on this. It claims that there are some issues with it that they have questions about, but the fact of the matter is what they're really doing is sitting on it. And she basically put the pressure on them today to release it to the public so that we can get about looking at this and finding ways to make sure that these kinds of things don't happen again. So again, the real issue, and I know there are a number of people out there, and I've already talked to a few who believe that in today's world you got to do what you got to do, so to speak. But at the same time, there is the issue of, for lack of a better term, hypocrisy. The argument, it becomes very, very uncomfortable when you talk one way and behave in another. It becomes very embarrassing. I know we had that historically with the issue of slavery in the early history of this nation. It was so difficult to climb aboard and talk in a very positive, very optimistic way about Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and all that it implied about the value of human life and every individual in society and in the world and all the rest of it, and then at the same time practice an institution, as we were practicing slavery during that same period. So, it seems to me that when the issue of hypocrisy is associated with something as major as this, it becomes a little bit more difficult to deal with and a little bit more difficult to justify. So it's going to be very interesting to watch that. But anyway, and let me just say before we go off that, and I want to make sure I give phone numbers and various other things. but while it's on my mind, before we go off that for the moment, Senator Feinstein raised some serious constitutional issues associated with this program, and she listed three specific areas where this policy, this program of the CIA's, might in fact violate the Constitution, violate separation of powers, in part because there's some evidence she claims to have that the CIA was actually spying on Congress, members of Congress. And one of the most interesting things is to look at the comments to the article. I looked at it in the New York Times, and I looked at some of the comments. And, of course, the comments are, why in heaven's name would anybody spy on Congress when Congress doesn't do anything and doesn't know anything and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all they are is a bunch of hacks and all this stuff. So that much of the negativism in terms of popular attitudes towards Congress, towards the Senate, came out in the course of this. But the fact of the matter is violation of separation powers, violation of the Fourth Amendment.
They've got a pretty interesting point. They don't quite have the money, because no longer can you have a one-income family like you had when my grandparents' generation roamed the earth and the working world. And all of those systems that were set up, Social Security, Medicare, all of those things were set up on people paying into the system. What we're seeing now is a society where all of that stuff's being broken down. We're pushing people into freelance, subcontract work, 1099 work, independent contractors, where you're your own boss. You're your own boss. Granted, you don't have a pot to you know what in. But you're your own boss. You got the title and the shiny little name tag on your shirt. But you're struggling to put food on the table. And I got to tell you, there's something really very, very wrong with that. So the question then has to start at, what kind of a society are we moving forward towards? Is this something that we're okay with? Poverty wages for more and more workers. Because as we're looking around, I don't know if you're paying attention, but since the Bush recession in 2008, wages have actually continued downward. And you go, well, I haven't gotten a pay cut, but you haven't gotten a raise. So as you're not getting a raise, what you're actually doing is you're falling behind. And you ask anybody, I just had a long conversation with a buddy of mine today. We went and we had lunch together, and he's like, man, he retired a couple of years ago, and he was in great shape when he retired. Thrilled to death, had money that he had saved. He was ready, man. He was one of those people you go, there's a guy who did everything right his entire life. He saved. He had a defined benefit retirement plan. He had a 401k. He had personal savings. He had Social Security. He had all of this stuff. And he looked at me and he goes, you can't afford it anymore. Things have just gotten outrageous. And everything's, wages are falling, and it's more and more. And he's helping out a friend who he's known for years. And you just look at this and you go, what have we done to our economy? And I'll tell you what we've done. We have created an economy for the betterment of the handful. We have created an economy that's good for the investor class, for the ownership class. Because, you know, if you go back and you remember the Bush years, Bush talked a lot about the ownership society. And most of us took that to believe, well, you know, it's, you know, we want people to own homes. No, that wasn't what it was really about. The ownership society was just that. It was the people who owned the country. And we all like to think that we own our little piece of it. I think the foreclosure crisis that came up out of the Bush collapse showed a lot of us that we're really not part of that ownership society. That when he was talking about that, it wasn't talking to us. So as I look at this, there are things we really seriously, honestly, and truthfully need to be doing immediately. And that's stop allowing ourselves to be divided. First, stop ourselves from being focus group tested with these little cute little sound bites of how, paycheck protection, when all it really means is we're screwing workers. Go down the list. You know, this nonsensical right to work. Look, I'm all in favor of a right to work. I think workers should have absolutely the right to work. I think they should have rights on the job. Yet, what do we find? The right to work that were peddled comes with no rights and no work. But it's a nice bumper sticker. It'll look nice on the back of your car, but not so much in your bank account. And, you know, to use the old Ronald Reagan line, are you better off now than you were 5 years ago? Are you better off now? Because understand, this is the Bush, Reagan, Bush ideology. This is what we're living. We're living their world. So when they go back and say, oh, well, Ronald Reagan did such a great job with the economy. No, this is what we're living. He has, without question, put his stamp here years later, still on our economy. And it's still there. This whole mantra of lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. How much lower can zero be? You know, we hear here in Pennsylvania, like when I talked yesterday with John Misek, who said that, you know, people are saying, well, we've got this onerous tax code. I go, well, is it really an onerous tax code when 3/4 of the people don't pay it? So, okay, you got this high tax rate. Great, great, fantastic. You got this new one, this huge tax rate. Does anybody pay it? Well, no. Then do you really have a high tax rate? Maybe for the handful of people who have no choice, they're not big enough to go get a magic box in Delaware. Maybe so. And maybe we should be helping those folks. And I've been saying for a while, close the Delaware loophole. Then we'll talk. First and foremost, close that box. Close the magic box. Close the magic box of globalized free trade, where what we put in are our future and our jobs and good-paying union jobs, and what we get are cheap plastic crap from who knows where with who knows what that'll last who knows how long. Am I wrong? I'm waiting for my conservative listeners to chime in and say, Rick, you know, you're dead wrong. You're flat wrong. Globalized free trade brought me a whole basket of junk that I could get for $25. It's wonderful. I love it. It's the best thing ever. You don't hear that, do you? The conservative arguments are pretty simple. Well, if we've got to do this because we're helping the rest of the world. Yeah, we're helping the rest of the world to be exploited while destroying ourselves. And it's just a sad, sad commentary. When we come back, I'll talk a little bit about our trade deficits, where we go, what we need to do, all of that stuff. Quick break, right back, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Go.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. Representatives George Miller and Joe Courtney have sent letters to fast food CEOs at McDonald's, Burger King, Yum! Brands, Wendy's, and Papa John's, outlining the growing concerns about their labor practices. The members of Congress want detailed information about the business models and labor practices at five of the nation's largest fast food companies. Representative Miller and Courtney say that the letters are the result of growing concern that the fast food labor practices are helping to drive up inequality, to stymie economic growth, and to strain state and local finances. Wage theft in the fast food industry is also an issue that the congressmen are concerned about. A Southern Union organizing effort is underway in Mobile, Alabama at the Austal USA shipyard. A business boom at the shipyard and a demand for highly skilled workers from around the country could be an organizing opportunity for unions. Ron Ault, president of the AFL-CIO's Metal Trades Department, told Working in These Times
that the six unions in the department are banding together in an organizing campaign at Austal USA. The Australian-owned Austal is a contractor for the U.S. Navy. Austal is hostile to unions and uses anti-union meetings to instill fear in workers there. While the South is generally hostile to unions, a nearby shipyard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is union with 6,000 workers. The Legislative Conference of America's Building Trades Unions is underway in Washington. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey said in his keynote speech that the one impression he strives to leave with union members, building trades leaders, and heads of industry is that today's building trades unions are change agents that are about cooperation, not conflict. McGarvey says the building trades unions are about collaboration and not division. He says the building trades unions have strong and proud traditions and values about protecting the interests of their members, their families, and the American middle class. A mediation tentative labor agreement has been reached for 200 flight attendants at U.S. Airways Express. Piedmont Airlines flight attendants, represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the tentative agreement with management includes economic improvements, better work rules, and other benefits for the regional flight attendants. The union says Piedmont flight attendants stayed united to get to the agreement reached with the help of the National Mediation Board. The ratification vote for the flight attendants starts March 17th and runs through April 9th. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research looks at the rights and limitations on public sector collective U.S. states. The report focuses on teachers, police, and firefighters. It examines whether the workers have the right to bargain collectively, whether that right includes the ability to bargain over wages, and whether public sector workers have the right to strike.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons of metal a day, I sure you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forgive my name, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, we've been seeing these numbers coming out. And every month you see the trade deficit numbers. They keep popping out. This last month was somewhere pretty close to $40 billion. And you look at all of this money that just seems to be going out of this country, some half a trillion dollars each and every year. And you kind of go, what could happen? What do you think would happen if we decided that we were going to have trade policy that, well, maybe some of that stuff would be built here? Here we are, a year and 49 days without a jobs plan here in the U.S., thanks to our Congress. Question is, what happens? Here to talk a little bit about our trade deficit and what we can do, hopefully, to try and turn things around. I've got Dean Baker on the line. Dean is a economist and the founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, the website. Dean, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah.
You know, I look at these numbers and just completely mind-blowing, some $40 billion last month. That we've shipped out of the country for a bunch of cheap plastic junk that we got from who knows where.
Well, it's cheap plastic junk. I mean, a lot of the stuff we're getting from abroad's just fine. It's good stuff, and that's part of the problem. People buy it because they prefer it to the U.S.-made stuff, or it's cheaper. It might be as good or cheaper, you know, but cheaper. So I'm not going to knock what we buy from overseas. The problem is it's not creating demand here. It's creating demand overseas. So at $40 billion a month, $500 billion a year is demand that is being generated in Canada and Mexico and China, wherever it might be, when it could be creating demand in the United States. And that creates a really big gap in demand, which is why we have unemployment.
Let me ask you, you said something there a second ago that people prefer it over U.S. products. I got to be honest. I go to the store shelves. I don't have an option. So I'm curious. You know, we keep hearing this that, well, we just preferred this to what we make. Do we still make a lot of this stuff?
A lot of times we don't. You know, it's very hard. You know, if you wanted to get a T-shirt that was made in the United States, you'd have a hell of a hard time finding one. So there's a lot of things. Most of our toys, you know, are made in overseas, largely China. You know, so a lot of products, if you wanted to get a U.S.-made version, it would be almost impossible to do. So, you know, we basically have outsourced everything.
So the question then becomes, here we are, you're looking at $500 billion with our trade deficits, and some of it's oil, some of it's some other things, but for the most part, it's China. And you look at this and you got to ask the question, what kind of trade policy do we have with them that encourages jobs to go overseas and us to buy their stuff and us to send money over there? Who benefits from this?
Well, the main story is we have an overvalued currency that makes their stuff very cheap. You know, the dollar is overvalued against other currencies, particularly the Chinese, but other currencies as well. So it makes it very cheap, and the beneficiaries are the people who are importing. So, you know, for example, Walmart has, you know, low-cost supply chains with China and other countries in the world. That's one of their big price advantages. Also, our manufacturers, most manufacturers, major manufacturers, I should say. You have domestic ones, but, you know, General Electric, the big manufacturer, almost without exception, they're going to have operations in China and other countries, and they benefit by having the ability to import these goods very cheaply. Gives them a competitive edge over domestic manufacturers.
So what do we do? You say our dollar's overvalued. How do we do what China does and devalue the currency?
Well, it's a question of negotiation. I mean, people talk about getting tough with China, and the issue is, you know, we negotiate with China all the time. The point is this has to be on the agenda. It has to be at the top of the agenda, because obviously we can't just, you know, go to China and give them, here's 10 things we want you to do. I mean, we do that, and they go, they'll laugh at us, you know, and, you know, we can't do that with China. We can maybe do that with Honduras or Guatemala. You can't do that with China. So it's really a political question here. If the Obama administration were prepared to say, look, you know, we sit down with China, we have all these issues with them, they have issues with us, and you negotiate. We'll give you some things, you know, other things that might be on our list. Goldman Sachs wants increased access to their financial markets. We'll go, you know, yeah, we want that, but that's less important. You have to raise the value of your currency against the dollar. So it really is a political question. Obviously, it's not a priority for the Obama administration. Maybe they talk about with China, maybe not. I'm not there, but in any case, they don't tell the Chinese government, this is what we need from you. What are we, you know, we'll give up other things in exchange for that.
Because you look at this, and I truly, I still believe we have a real jobs crisis in this country. There's so much idle labor. And I know there's been some talk lately of labor tightening. But I know people who have been unemployed for quite some time. It doesn't seem to be tightening for them.
Yeah, well, we still have a 6.7% unemployment rate. We're down somewhere around 7 million jobs from our trend path. You know, I've been really kind of disgusted with my profession. I don't know if I was saying, well, you'd be more disgusted than I already am. I mean, it is their fault we had this downturn to begin with. They all say, oh, who could have known? Well, if they were doing their jobs, they would have known.
Right.
But you know, to now say, oh, we really don't have a problem about unemployment. We're just redefining it. All these people just decided not to work. You know, that's just ridiculous. It's pathetic. They don't have a basis for saying that. It's sort of like, you know, you set a goal for yourself. You're gonna stop smoking. You know, you're smoking 2 packs a day. So you go, you know, that's going to be your goal. You'll stop next Tuesday, and it's Wednesday, and you're still smoking 2 packs. And then you go, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll cut back, you know. And then, you know, eventually you're cutting back a cigarette a day or something, you know. That's not meeting your goal. And what they're doing here, we should be having somewhere around 7 million more jobs than we have. And rather than figuring out, okay, how do we get 7 million jobs, they're just saying, oh, no, all these people just don't want to work. And you know, that just deserves contempt from the public, because it really is absurd.
Or you've got, you know, like our governor here in Pennsylvania who seems to love to, you know, the whole idea that, you know, people are lazy and they don't want to work because, you know, they're drug addicts. You know, they can't pass a drug test.
There are many employers.
Well, you know, what gets me though is, you know, you go, okay, these people were working. You know, so what's their theory? That they suddenly all became drug addicts? You know, these people had jobs. They were supporting their families, you know, just 6 or 7 years ago. So, you know, we have two options here. One, you know, just millions of people across the country suddenly, you know, became lazy and decided they wanted to do drugs. Or two, the economy went to hell. And, you know, I think two looks much more plausible than one.
So then what should we be doing as a nation? Because I look at the stimulus package from the beginning of the Obama administration, much, much too small. I think most rational people look at it. It wasn't enough. What should we be doing to get job creation back towards the top of the list? You know, there were some who were hopeful that the appointment of Janet Yellen would help. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, a few things. Again, trade really has to be front and center because that's, you know, we're throwing a lot of money in the garbage that way from the standpoint of creating jobs. I mean, it's just that simple. We're throwing the money in the garbage. But on top of that, you know, we can do things with federal spending that creates jobs. I mean, it's, you know, you get this bizarre thing, you know, people are opposed to stimulus. Most are Republicans. Government doesn't create jobs. And you just go, so teachers aren't working. I don't even know what that was supposed to mean. I mean, we know it can create jobs. I mean, if there are better ways, you know, if we had, you know, their job creators, you know, if they're all rushing out trying to hire people, wonderful, but they're not. So, you know, we could have had a bigger stimulus. We could still have a bigger stimulus. We have all sorts of infrastructure needs. State and local governments could be hiring back a lot of the people they laid off the last few years. That's another way to create jobs. The Fed, you know, Yellen, I hope for good things from her. I think she's the best person to be Fed chair for many decades. But, you know, it's got limited powers. I would like to see her try to be more aggressive, but she can't unilaterally do things. She has to bring along the other members, of the Open Market Committee. It's 11 people other than herself. You know, how much more they could do, I don't know, but I certainly would like to see her try.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the story on that.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Dean Baker, economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dean's name. It'll take you right there. You know, Marco Rubio just gave a speech on his ideas of how we're going to fix our trade and how we're going to get the economy turned around. And it just seemed to me to be more of the same Republican talking points, lower taxes, more free trade, all of the same things, just with a different rebranding, which I guess is what came out of the CPAC conference, more rebranding of the same bad ideas. How much lower can our tax rates go? How much more can we deregulate before we realize that maybe that's not the right answer?
Well, you know, we've experimented with the low tax rate story for the last three decades, and, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, it's not going to get firms to invest more. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember Paul O'Neill, President Bush's, the second President Bush's first Treasury Secretary. He was asked during his nomination hearings, you know, do you think tax cuts will, you know, create growth, lead you invest more? He said, you know, and this is a guy who ran several very large businesses. He goes, you know, I never met a business person who invested because of tax breaks. He goes, we're happy to have them, but that's not why you invest. And, you know, I think the data overwhelmingly backs up, though, this is kind of a joke. You know, sure, I'd like to pay less taxes. You would, you know, sure, it's great. But, you know, we're not going to go invest based on that. In terms of deregulation, you go, you know, the deregulation, look what happened in West Virginia where we polluted tens of thousands, is over 100,000 people's water for more than a week. You know, people got sick. I don't think anyone died there. But, I mean, it's pretty serious. You know, you can't get water out of your tap. And, you know, this is the 21st century. You know, this is kind of a joke, you know. So deregulation is somehow the key. You know, they always find some silly regulation. And guaranteed, there's silly regulations.
Sure.
But that's not what they want to get rid of. They want to get rid of regulations that we really need that protect people's health and safety.
So you're against the whole idea of freedom water?
Yeah, freedom water. That's a good line for it. Yeah, I mean.
Well, I mean, it was Freedom Industries' pollution into American waters. Water. You've got privatized water system with a polluter, and I ask the question: is American Water going to sue them for polluting their water? I mean, not even the citizens. I don't even know if the citizens have any standing other than the uncontrollable vomiting that they were fortunate enough to get by ingesting the Freedom Water.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is really kind of an incredible story, and this is what we're talking about with regulation. You know, we had the fertilizer plant in Texas that exploded.
Yep.
And, you know, killed a number of people, took a neighborhood with it. You know,
I stood there.
That's regulation. That's, you know, that's supposed to prevent things like that. And, you know, Texas, they're happy they don't have regulation. Well, great, their neighborhood blew up, so that must make them really happy. I mean, that's what regulation's about. You could always find some cases where it was excessive, where you had someone who was abusive as a bureaucrat. You know, it's a big country. That's going to happen. But, you know, the reality is we need regulations to prevent things like that from happening.
When we stood on the streets in West Texas and looked at the aftermath of that explosion, that 93-foot around, 10-foot deep hole in the earth that blew basically a school almost off its foundation, the entire roof and most of the front off of a nursing home, and then homes for probably a half a mile around were just demolished. and you go, okay, there's your deregulation.
Yeah, you know, and again, as I say, you could always have a legitimate discussion on any particular regulation. Is this the best way to structure it? And clearly, in many, many cases, it's not. I mean, you know, and that's an honest thing to debate. But the idea that, you know, carte blanche, we're just going to take an axe and, you know, chop out half the pages of the Federal Register, you know, that's nuts. And again, this is what you get. You get water people can't drink in Virginia, in West Virginia. You get exploding factories in Texas, and you know, we'll see many more things like that. I mean, we have obviously a long list of things. We could talk about mines collapsing where miners died. I mean, there's a long list of things we could point to like that. And of course, there's many smaller things that don't get national publicity that, you know, ruin people's lives, kill people because you didn't have regulation that should have been there.
You know, we're in the middle of this talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which people are calling the NAFTA on steroids. Even in Marco Rubio's little spiel, he was pimping for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. I'm curious, you know, you look at NAFTA, which really was, you know, the first one that brought us a lot of the destructive stuff, the huge loss of jobs. You know, in the 20 years since NAFTA was passed, can you make a cogent argument that it was beneficial for the U.S. or for Mexico? I mean, is there something that I'm missing?
It's pretty hard to see. You know, we obviously lost a lot of jobs to Mexico, you know, not entirely because of NAFTA, but clearly it played a role in it. And from Mexico's standpoint, they've had the worst growth of any major country in Latin America in the last two decades. You're very hard-pressed to say that, you know, that NAFTA somehow benefited them. I mean, you could always make the argument it would have been worse otherwise. And, you know, who could say? Sure, it could always be worse. But, you know, you compare Mexico to how, you know, the growth they've seen in Brazil and in Argentina. You know, pick your country. Mexico's done worse than all of them. So you're pretty hard-pressed to see how someone benefited from that, other than obviously some corporate interests that, you know, got very wealthy, had high profits. But, and, you know, that's on both sides of the border. So you had Slim, I'm forgetting his last name now.
Carlos Slim,
yes. Carlos Slim was
telecom guy.
One of the richest people in the world. I'm sure he's very rich back in, you know, 1993 when NAFTA was signed, but he's a hell of a lot richer today. And, you know, again, this is part of the deregulation. He was well positioned, apparently, to benefit from the deregulation that Mexico went through following NAFTA.
You know, I got an email here as we were talking, and Randall points out that, you know, one of the other things that the right points out quite often, or used to say that you don't hear much anymore, is that the lower tax rates would bring lower interest rates, especially on things like credit cards. And he pointed out that the credit card interest is 29%. So not much help there, I guess, right?
Yeah, you know, of course that varies by person, but, you know, credit card companies have, you know, often taken advantage that they've gotten lower interest rates, not passed those on to borrowers, so it just means higher profits for them. So it's, you know, you go down the list of things, list of areas, it's hard to see where most people benefit, and obviously what the biggest item for most people in terms of their standard of living is their wage, and real wages have been stagnant or falling for, you know, most of the last, certainly since 2000, since we had the recession, 2001, I guess I should say. So it's very hard to see how most people are benefiting from this economy.
So last line of question then, how do we turn that around? In light of what's going to happen, because I don't think the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is going to go through. I hope Obama doesn't get fast-track authority. What's the answer forward?
Well, I think we have to focus attention on, you know, what are the big issues. You know, we started talking about the trade deficit. People jump up and down and yell and scream about the budget deficit. They don't pay attention to the trade deficit. The trade deficit's costing us jobs. It's costing us jobs today. The budget deficit, you know, I would argue we want a bigger deficit right now. We need that to generate demand. But in any case, even a worst-case scenario, we got our big deficit hawks here. A very, very long-term story, if at all. So we have to get a focus on the trade deficit, and again, we have to get people to understand it's actually under our control. President Obama could do it. He could sit down with China. If he can't do it, he should come to us and tell us, you know, and say, you know, look, I told the Chinese I'd give them this, I'd give them that, and they said, no, we'll never raise the value. That's not true. He knows that's not true, and he's not going to say that.
Right. You said that you want a bigger deficit, and I think I just heard most of my conservative listeners hit the floor. Because we're told quite often we're basically Greece or Spain. You know, we're broke. We don't have enough money to keep the lights on. We can't light the Christmas tree.
Well, this is, again, one of the cases. Let's look at what the markets are telling us. We have extremely low interest rates. The interest rate on 10-year Treasury bonds is about 2.7%. If you go back when President Bush was in the White House, it was typically over 4%, sometimes over 5%. When President Reagan was in the White House, it was around 6%, even 7%. The markets are telling us they're happy to lend us money. So this idea we're about to be Greece, I mean, I give you 101 reasons why we, no way on earth are we going to be Greece, but, you know, don't listen to me. Just listen to the financial market. We have people prepared to lend us trillions of dollars at very low interest rates that wouldn't do that for Greece.
I'm with you, but, you know, it's inundated. We're inundated with that message. We're broke. We can't afford it. We can't invest in education. We can't invest in infrastructure or broadband access. I mean, where I live in outside of Carlisle, where I live, I've actually got worse internet service than places like Estonia. I'm basically in a third world wasteland when it comes to internet.
Well, you know, the country as a whole, you know, I have a friend who's visiting us this year from Korea. And, you know, Korea, I mean, obviously Korea is a much wealthier country than it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But still, it's quite striking. You know, he laughs at the state of our internet connections. This is in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
So,
oh, I know.
So, you know, this is, it's ridiculous. This should be a priority that we have, you know, high-speed internet connections, because this is affordable. Again, you know, referring to Korea, which, again, I understand is not a poor country, but the point is if they could afford it, surely we could afford it.
I'm with you. Dean, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time with us. Dean Baker, economist, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, the website. Dean, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rich Smith Show for working people from the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've begun the story of how America's political color scheme became red for Republicans and blue for Democrats. History shows that the colors used today are completely reverse of the conventional political uses of blue and red worldwide. Europe and North America, including the United States, have generally associated red with left-leaning parties. Think Red China and the red associated with Soviet Marxism. Traditionally, political mapmakers in the U.S. used blue to designate Republicans and red for Democrats. And in the Civil War, the Republican Union was blue with uniforms and everything else. There was a significant exception during the Civil War, though. Battlefield mapmakers provided blue pencils to mark movements of the Southern rebels, who were mostly Democrats, and also red pencils to mark movements of the mostly Republican Union troops. Join us again for more red and blue confusion. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Medical science has long known that the optic nerve runs from the retina of our eyeballs to the visual cortex of our brains, letting us see what's going on around us. Don't look now, but another optic nerve has evolved. Rather than running to our brains, however, this one goes outward, allowing others to see us and also hear us having what we assume to be private, even intimate, conversations. Those others are the out-of-control security agencies in England and the U.S., secretly vacuuming up everyone's communications, even though we're not suspected of any illegalities. The Brits took the lead in this latest visual intrusion, giving it the code name of optic nerve. They are tapping into the retinas of such internet applications as Yahoo webcam chats, Google Hangouts, and Microsoft Skype. Millions of us have these services in our homes and offices, enabling us to have private video talks with someone or some group across town, or even around the world. Now we learn, though, that we're not alone. The spooks have hacked into the fiber optic networks of Yahoo, and probably others, to grab, view, listen to, and store millions of these personal communications. Creepy? Yes, Orwellian-level creepy. As Yahoo put it, this represents a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. Lest you think the spies are only gathering info about terrorist plots, the British agency concedes that up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam images it has purloined contain sexually explicit content. One agent said of the mass window peeping, a surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking! Not that they would do that, but that you would be sneaking peeks at them.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, the numbers coming out from Obamacare right now, not bad. I mean, you got to give them credit. They kind of turned the healthcare.gov thing around a little bit. In fact, the president did this weird little sit down with this comedian who does this Between the Ferns or whatever it was, which I didn't find all that interesting. Kind of slow, and I you know, it's one of those things where maybe someone thought it was funny. Wasn't me. But, you know, hey, you know, bless him for trying. But a number of people have come to it. In fact, more than 4.2 million people thus far have signed up for the dreaded Obamacare. That's through the 1st of March, according to a report put out today by the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, originally, they had targeted the number of 5.6 million by the end of February. And by the end of March, they wanted to get to 7 million. Now they've kind of changed those projections a little bit. They're dropping down the end of March to about 6 million. And they're, you know, they're hoping for a big surge here, obviously, in the last month. They were hoping for, I think it was something like 40% of people under 35 to sign up. Right now you got about a quarter of the people enrolling. And you're going to see a big push to trying to get younger people to say, hey, you know what? It's affordable. It's reasonable. When I was 20, when I was 25, well, actually, when I was 20, when I was 25, I had a good paying union job that made sure I had world class health care. But when I was 20, I was basically bulletproof. I was in college and, you know, nothing. I didn't worry about anything. So I understand what it's like to be 20 years old and go, well, you know, not me. It's never going to happen to me. But it does. And, you know, I knew people who were, when I was younger, who had these problems. So, you know, I'm hoping that the push towards the end of March, which is the end of the first enrollment period, I'm hoping to see a big push. And then I'm hoping that maybe they extend that a little bit. I know some states have extended their Medicaid expansion a little bit. So we'll see. But here's the thing. I mean, the numbers are looking in the right direction. We have seen the number of uninsured in the U.S. fall to a five-year low, under 16% of the population uninsured, which is fantastic when you figure we were over 17 at the end of last year. So moving in the right direction. But that's not going to stop the political hacks. That's not going to stop the attacks. The people who like the Michelle Bachmans and the Louis Gohmerts and the Republicans who are making their last stand. Because understand, these people, they feel cornered. Because they know if they can't stop it here soon, this becomes like Medicare. This becomes like getting Medicare away from my grandmother. Never gonna happen. So they know this. They've seen the model. They've seen the process. They've seen this in action. And they've been fighting Medicare, you know, since it passed in the late 60s. So what you then start to see is you see the desperation. You see the BS coming out. And we've seen these ads being played all across the country. And this latest one, the Washington Post has now given three solid Pinocchios to, kind of makes you go, wow, this is really just, let me play the ad, because I think it's important that you hear what kind of, I mean, it's really horrible. I mean, when you sit, this ad just grabs you and makes you, made me angry, to be honest with you, until you realize that it's really, it's just BS.
My name is Julie Boonstra, and I have leukemia. Being diagnosed with the cancer, that was the scariest thing I have ever faced. Because of Obamacare, I am now stuck with a plan that doesn't work for me. My choice was taken away from me. All I want is to be listened to. There are thousands of people out there who are hurting because of Obamacare.
Oh, yeah, they're hurting because of Obamacare. Don't you love the music? I do. Wow, the music just makes gets you in that state. She's got this very, very, sympathetic kind of voice. You know, I have cancer, and I'm gonna, and there are people out there who are hurting, and it's Obama's fault. She goes on, and it gets better.
When I heard that Congressman Peters was going after my credibility, it was devastating. I just want Congressman Peters to help me, to listen to me. Instead, he's trying to silence me. Cancer is hard enough. I just want to be happy with my plan.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Did you catch that? I mean, the first time I watched it, that almost slipped by me. I've got cancer. I just want to be happy with my plan? Really? I mean, who wrote that? I want health care. I want to make sure that I get the access to the care that I need. I want to know that the chemo drugs I'm going to get are not going to break me. To me, this ad should be the beginnings of, this is why we need single payer. Here's a woman who's got cancer. She shouldn't be worrying about having, how am I going to pay for it? What am I going to do to my family? What am I going to do to the future? She should be worrying about, hey, I got to get better. I got to fight this. I've got to put all my strength into fighting it. But no. She wants a better plan.
And I want it for everybody else out there that's being hurt by this.
Yeah, all the people
trying to speak out for you, and I'm trying to get Washington to listen to us.
Yeah, I mean, really, evil, Obamacare, evil! I know, Rick, the poor woman has cancer, right? A little empathy, right? And look, I do. I do have empathy. Until you realize, and this is the part that, again, you see these ads, you see this stuff go on, and you kind of go, wait a second. Again, I'm very jaded. Anytime I see the Koch brothers put out an ad, the ad was done by Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers group. This woman, Miss Boonstra, turns out, before we get into the actual facts, turns out her husband, the head of the Republican Party in their area, in the Washtenaw County, there in Michigan, Mark Boonstra, he's the former GOP chairman who Governor Rick Snyder appointed to the Michigan Court of Appeals back in 2012. And, beyond the, hey, let's pay for play kind of thing, which, you think about it how you have to think about it. It just seems like a quid pro quo to me. But you look at the plan, because she wants to be happy with her plan. She's got cancer. I want to be happy with my plan. So when this first came out, she said, I had a plan I liked, and that was good, and my doctors were happy, and we were going to be able to go forward. I could afford it. And now the dreaded Obama. Obamacare took my plan. So it caught the attention of the Detroit News. And good, finally, there's some investigative reporting and fact-checkers like at the Washington Post and a number of other fact-checking agencies that kind of cast doubt on the accuracy of the commercial. People like me going, what? That doesn't sound right. So what they found out, what the Detroit News and the rest of them found out, is the plan that she went and got through Obamacare, the dreaded, evil, nasty Obamacare, is a plan called the Blue Cross Premium Gold Plan. It's even called gold, which caps patients' out-of-pocket expenses at about $5,100 per year, at $5,100 a year, lower than the Obamacare maximum of $6,350 a year. So just based on that one thing, the plan she had before would have been capped at $6,350. She's going to save $1,200 on the out-of-pocket from the other plan. So this, oh, I can't afford it, fallacious. But, Rick, I know. Maybe the premiums were really high, right? According to the Detroit News, her old plan, the one she wanted to be happy with, was $1,100 a month, or, as they point out, $13,200 per year. That did not include anything that she spent on copays, prescription drugs, out-of-pocket expenses, any of that stuff. So she spent $13,200 a year just for crummy coverage. That, again, still got to pay copays, still got to pay the drugs out of your pocket, and whatever else pops up. And as anybody knows who's been through the medical wheels, there's a lot of things that, well, just not covered. Now, you look at the Blue Cross Premier Gold Plan, gold-plated health care. Her plan costs $571 a month, or $6,852 per year. So just looking at its face, the premiums that you pay per year, just almost half. She's almost paying half. Now, you're going to pay $5,100 out of your pocket if you stay in-network and you do the hospitals and all the deductibles and all that stuff. That's everything. $5,100, that's it. So the entire policy cost for a year, $11,952, about 12 grand, let's say. That's $1,200 less than what she was paying just for the premium. Now, when the people at the Michigan Blue, when the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan spokesman told her this and tried to explain it, no, that can't be true. Because the Koch brothers have told me so. Because I drank the Kool-Aid. I've been gulping it down. My Republican chairman husband and person who sits on the Court of Appeals, he wouldn't lie. He wouldn't use me as a shill. And what's interesting to me is the Koch brothers have spent more than $30 million with ads like that across this country to convince you and me and everyone else that Obamacare is a failure and it's going to cost us money. Look, am I thrilled with what we got out of the Affordable Care Act? No. There are a lot of things I think could be better. And a lot of things I hope we're going to change. But what this is, and this is one of those things that you've got to wake up and realize, what this is purely that tugging at the heartstring, that emotional response that you hear this and you immediately turn away. You immediately repulse. How dare Obama do this to this poor, nice lady who just wants to be happy with her health care plan? It's the understory of all this. It's the understory of these people who they feel cornered. The wealth class of this country doesn't want you to have access to this health care. They don't. They want to keep it on the level of pay or die. And every time I ask a conservative, every time I ask a Republican who tells me, well, Obamacare is going to cost too much. And look, I still agree. Obamacare costs more than I would like. The Affordable Care Act still has the profit motive in it. Personally, I think that shouldn't be there. You want to bring those costs down? Just open up. Let me buy Medicare. That's simple. Give me choice. Where are my conservative friends in that? Where are the people who say we should have choice? We should let them compete. Where's that? Did I miss that? Did I miss that day? Was there a memo that I missed? Because I don't think so. I don't think I've missed that memo. I don't think I missed the meeting. I don't think I missed the video or the audio clip or whatever. It's not there because the Republicans really don't believe in competition. They really don't, really, really at their core, They're monopolistic, authoritarian, totalitarian. These are people who want absolute and total control, which is what we see coming out of groups like Americans for Dogs and Puppies and all of these euphemistically named groups that these billionaires are funding. And I know, as Michelle Bachmann says, the left has all the billionaires. Like George Soros is all of the billionaires. So I look at this, and you know, I ask the question, you know, at the end of this, how much of this do we put up with? Because, look, I feel for this woman. And, you know, as I'm watching the commercial the first time without looking at the story at all, I let my emotions run with it. Man, I feel for her. I feel for anybody who has cancer, who has to go through it, and the process, and all of the paperwork, and all of the bills, and the mountains, and stacks, and all of this stuff. And I ask the question again, how much more of this do we put up with? You know, I remember when my grandmother was sick. You know, she came home from the hospital to piles of bills. Now, it's a good thing that my aunt took care of her and took care of all that, but what if you didn't have that? You know, this woman's 49 years old. Her kids have moved on, they're not of the age where they can come back probably and take care of her. You know, who knows? I don't know what the situation is, but you know, when you're in your mid-40s, late-40s, you're pretty much... You better figure out how to take care of yourself. You're the one paying your own bills. You're the one taking care of yourself. Imagine coming home to those stacks. It's just one of those things that I think as a nation, we had better come to some reality over, because ads like this are just destroying our political process, because they're so badly skewed. They're so badly wrong. And I guess that's, you know, that's one of my big problems in all this. It's so badly wrong. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the Stitcher app, the podcast, all that right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. Representatives George Miller and Joe Courtney have sent letters to fast food CEOs at McDonald's, Burger King, Yum! Brands, Wendy's, and Papa John's, outlining the growing concerns about their labor practices. The members of Congress want detailed information about the business models and labor practices at five of the nation's largest fast food companies. Representative Miller and Courtney say that the letters are the result of growing concern that the fast food labor practices are helping to drive up inequality, to stymie economic growth, and to strain state and local finances. Wage theft in the fast food industry is also an issue that the congressmen are concerned about. A Southern Union organizing effort is underway in Mobile, Alabama, at the Austal USA shipyard. A business boom at the shipyard and a demand for highly skilled workers from around the country could be an organizing opportunity for unions. Ron Ault, president of the AFL-CIO's Metal Trades Department, told Working in These Times that the six unions in the department are banding together in an organizing campaign at Austal USA. The Australian-owned Austal is a contractor for the U.S. Navy. Austal is hostile to unions and uses anti-union meetings to instill fear in workers there. While the South is generally hostile to unions, a nearby shipyard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is union with 6,000 workers.
The Legislative Conference of America's Building Trades Unions is underway in Washington. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey said in his keynote speech that the one impression he strives to leave with union members, building trades leaders, and heads of industry is that today's building trades unions are change agents that are about cooperation, not conflict. McGarvey says the building trades unions are about collaboration and not division. He says the building trades unions have strong and proud traditions and values about protecting the interests of their members, their families, and the American middle class. A mediation tentative labor agreement has been reached for 200 flight attendants at U.S. Airways Express. Piedmont Airlines flight attendants, represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the tentative agreement with management includes economic improvements, better work rules, and other benefits for the regional flight attendants. The union says Piedmont flight attendants stayed united to get to the agreement reached with the help of the National Mediation Board. The ratification vote for the flight attendants starts March 17th and runs through April 9th. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research looks at the rights and limitations on public sector collective bargaining in the 50 U.S. states. The report focuses on teachers, police, and firefighters. It examines whether the workers have the right to bargain collectively, whether that right includes the ability to bargain over wages, and whether public sector workers have the right to strike.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe, and we don't buy that here. 'Cause in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
Yes, we could be the Texas of the Northeast. Wouldn't that be grand? Wouldn't it be great that we'd be the place that has so low of regulation that a fertilizer plant could just blow up and blow a 90-foot hole, 90-foot around, 10-foot deep hole in the earth, and nobody go to jail for it? Wouldn't that be grand? I think it'd be fantastic. Of course, I'm being facetious, but it is what it is. Our stat of the day from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog points out that the world's ultra-high net worth crowd, those are individuals with at least $30 million, that number now stands at 167,669 people, according to a Knight Frank report. Their total wealth, $20.1 trillion in 2013, almost half as much as the combined net worth of 4.2 billion global adults who held less than $100,000 in wealth. So what you've got is you've got what John Edwards talked about, the two Americas and really the two globes. Those who are wildly wealthy, and, well, there are the rest of us. Anyway, here to talk a little bit about what's going on with the roads and bridges. I know we've been talking about we need some investment in infrastructure. There was a bill passed at the end of last year. I thought it was a little bit too little, but we'll find out. We've got our good friend Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for Pennsylvania for the Laborers International Union. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So, you know, I look at, you know, it's construction season's on the horizon. So as someone who drives a lot, I'm dreading seeing the orange cones, but I'll be happy to know that I'm not going to fall into the ocean or into the water ocean when I go to New York and New Jersey, into the drink here in Pennsylvania.
That's exactly right, Rick. I mean, construction season is upon us, and I was at the National Building Trades Conference in Washington and had some construction of my own to deal with on the major highways. But it's good. It's a good sign that people are going to be going back to work, particularly in Pennsylvania. And we're all looking forward to a better year in 2014. I mean, obviously, and you're right. Look, I'm going to agree with you. $2.5 billion was not enough. It's not enough. In fact, that TFAP report basically said, look, we need at least $3.5 billion.
Yep.
We'll take the $2.5 billion. But you're right, we absolutely need more, no question.
Yeah, a little earlier in the program, we talked with Dean Baker from the Center of Economic Policy Priorities, and as he pointed out, you know, the rest, the markets, and don't take his word for it, we're not broke, the markets are willing to lend us money at dirt cheap rates. The fact that we're not taking advantage of it, just kind of dumb on our part, especially when we have so many needs.
That's right. That's absolutely right. We have tons of needs, tons of bridges, tons of roads, tons of streets that need to be repaved, redone, I mean, restarted. I mean, we have a very old and decaying infrastructure in Pennsylvania, and it's time for them to, it's time for our infrastructure to get a lot of love, but more importantly, our workers to get a lot of love. I mean, we need guys and gals out there working on these projects that are going to last, you know, 5 or 6 years or 10 years, 15 years, whatever the case may be. But we definitely need it, and this is going to be a welcome boost to a lot of working families in Pennsylvania.
And to our economy as a whole. But I wanted to ask about this program that PennDOT has rolled out under Governor Corbett, and it's called the Rapid Bridge Replacement Program, where evidently they've bundled some 500 of our structurally deficient bridges, and they're privatizing them for the next 35 years. Something. Explain to me what this is.
Certainly. What this is part of the P3 proposal. What happened was several years ago, and I think it's 3 years ago now, the P3 bill was passed in Pennsylvania. It's comprised of five individuals. The governor gets an appointee, and each of the caucus members gets an appointee as well. And we were fortunate to get a laborer on that board as well. And their job is to really take a look at all these proposals and then match public dollars with private dollars. And in terms of the rapid bridge replacement, they accepted proposals already from several teams in order to have dibs on those bridges. And, of course, they're going to start off with 100 to 200 bridges next year, and then they're going to have about 15 years to complete everything. So the proposals were submitted. They're going to be narrowed down to about three or four bidders. Right now we're at about five, and it's going to be narrowed down to about three or four in June. The announcement's going to be made public as to who they are, and then the final award is going to be announced in September before the contracts are actually signed in December. So that's also going to be instrumental in putting people back to work in Pennsylvania, because these are going to be good-paying, family-sustaining jobs. Now, I've seen the list of the teams, and with the exception of one, we're looking at union-friendly teams, contractors that have had experience with working people, with unions, and then positive experience. And I do believe that one team is going to be weeded out at the end of the day, simply because right now we're looking at a very favorable board as it relates to working people. And so, I mean, we're excited about this prospect. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. No. But it's a good start for us. And again, the bottom line is job creation and putting people back to work in Pennsylvania over several years. I mean, you're looking at projects that are going to need 15 to 20 years to be completed. Not individual projects, but, I mean, overall. Because
right.
500 to 600 bridges, I mean, that's a lot of work, brother. And, of course, they're going to start with the most structurally deficient, most crumbling. Because, Rick, my biggest fear leading up to this, and quite honestly, I'm still afraid that something tragic will happen here. I mean, it could happen at any day, but at least we've taken proactive measures to reduce that possibility. And I'm still hopeful that we don't have a repeat of the Minnesota as we did several years ago.
Yeah, the I-35 collapse. I'm right there with you.
That's right.
But I look at this, and, you know, I'm extremely skeptical. And, you know, there's a lot of questions around these public-private partnerships. And I understand. We need the bridges. I get that. But what's the enticement for the private sector to put their money into it? Because, you know, I've had conversations with Donna Cooper in the past, who was one of the, I forget what her title with the Rendell administration was, but she and I'm sure you would remember. What did she do for Rendell?
She was the Secretary of Policy and Planning for Rendell.
There you
go. That's exactly right.
I forgot that. But she told me flat out, she goes, when they wanted to lease the turnpike, the people who wanted to buy it wanted a guarantee of their profits for the entire, whatever length, 50, 75 years. They wanted a guarantee not only of all the profits that they should get from that, but whatever profits they could have gotten doing anything else. So I look at this and I go, you know, with that in the back of my head, what brings the private sector money into a plan like this where most people are going, where are you getting paid?
Right. I mean, a lot of this is going to come from the transportation funding. There's no question about it, because you can't have a P3 without the public component. So before all of this started, I mean, we were really asking ourselves, I mean, what's the point in having a P3 if you don't have the public component in place there, you know? And, of course, you know, the discussions are going to continue about adding more dollars, more public dollars. And what this does is it allows those teams to come up with the best proposals, the most responsible bidders, and really getting the biggest bang for their buck. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But it's a good start, and it's a heck of a lot better, Rick, than what we had before with nobody working, nobody out there with a good-paying, family-sustaining job, and nothing in the pipeline. And again, I want to get back to your original point, which is absolutely correct. $2.5 billion ain't enough. There's no doubt about it. But at least we're going to get the process started, and we will see if we have a new administration next year that could advocate for a greater amount of money down the road as well. Because, I mean, this is patchwork, man. This is patchwork. This is not even close to what we need in Pennsylvania, because those needs have gone, I mean, they've been sitting there for years. I mean, we're to the point of decay. And who knows what we're going to find when we actually start digging and repairing some of these things. I mean, we may have to start from scratch in some parts of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So I think this is going to help us definitely in the short run, and I'm hoping it's in the long run, Rick. But without further investments, without a longer, more strategic plan, we're going to wind up in the same place that we were 10 years ago, in 10 years, and we simply can't have it.
Now,
so we have to maximize our resources right now.
I'm with you. But again, maybe I don't understand. That's why I'm asking you. How does the private sector get their money back? Are we talking about cash boxes on every bridge like you see in New York City? Or is it tax dollars? And if it's tax dollars, why aren't we just doing it for ourselves?
Right. It's a combination of both. And the reason why the tax dollars can't, let's be honest here. We don't have a legislature or a governor that wants to do the right thing in terms of revenue generation, meaning taxes. Okay,
right.
I'm just going to cut to the chase. There is a lack of political will. So what they wanted to do was say, okay, why don't we share the pain here? Obviously, it's going to become tax dollars, but down the road, it's going to be a combination of those cash boxes of tolls that are going to go back to those individuals that pump the money into this anyway. It's going to be a combination of private and public dollars that are going to help these projects get started. And maybe down the road, we'll wean off of the tax dollars, although I still think you need a greater investment in our infrastructure. You can't do it by yourself. And I think that this was the least, this is the plan that had the least amount of resistance, Rick. I mean, we've got a governor that is a disciple of Grover Norquist, doesn't want to tax anything whatsoever. He's getting backlash on this because, of course, there's going to be a 30-cent tax. Gas tax that motorists are going to have to eventually pay. It was the plan that made the most sense at the time that would put people back to work as well. Should we have been backed in that corner? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But this is a direct result, Rick, of poor leadership at the top that does not address things in a timely fashion. So you're left with proposals that are less than perfect, can get the job done, but the fact remains that it's unproven.
Yeah.
It's unproven in Pennsylvania, brother.
Yeah.
I, as a member of the laborers, am willing to take that chance because it will help put my guys and gals back to work off the bench and putting food on the table for their families. Is it risky? Yes, but I will take that risk as it relates to my members 7 days a week.
Well, I mean, I'll take the chance, too, as someone who doesn't want to fall off a bridge. But, you know, it's one of these things that I think people need to realize. This is a failure of leadership. This is a failure in the belief in what we, the people, are able to accomplish. So now we've got to pay homage to the corporate chair. We've got to pay our profit. And look, you know, if taxpayers are okay with that, then, and if people are willing to pay the tolls, then okay, this is where we're going. But I just want to make sure that that's one of the things that people understand. Look, I'm not against building. I want to build all kinds of stuff. I want to put people back to work doing all kinds of stuff because we need things. But I look at this and I go, I'm still someone who believes if it needs to be done, we should be able to do it for ourselves. It's that simple. Last question I've got on this. These are going to be prevailing wage jobs, right? They haven't figured out how to skirt that, right?
They will not skirt that. We will not hear of any such talk, and no such talk has even been close to hitting our ears. Nothing of the sort. These are all prevailing wage jobs, absolutely. Public projects, prevailing wage, good-paying, family-sustaining. I mean, it may sound like a good soundbite, but, brother, at the end of the day, when that cash comes in and that check is cashed and people have food on the table and clothes on their backs and they're pumping money into the communities, that's when you know it's going to be effective.
No, I'm with you. And because, you know, the part of me that makes me a little skeptical is the private part. I know in California when they built the Bay Bridge, they figured out how to way to skirt the prevailing wage and actually brought in Chinese welders to do
right.
an awful lot of the work. And I don't want to see that here in Pennsylvania. I mean, if we're going to be paying the freight, I want to make sure that the people of Pennsylvania get those jobs and that money stays here. That's all.
That's absolutely right, Rick. I mean, we have to ensure that that takes place and takes precedence. And one of the best ways to do that is by ensuring that we have a new governor in 2015, someone who's going to stand up for the working person and say, no, these jobs have to be prevailing wage. And again, I want to reiterate that there's no talk about them not becoming prevailing wage right now. But we want to make sure that that's not the case with
right.
a change of leadership in 2015.
You most certainly want to stay vigilant on that front because
yes,
the last thing I want to see is a bunch of transient workforce come through, take the
right.
money and run and leave us with some shoddy work. That's my fear.
That's right. That's right.
Abe, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. It's always great. I appreciate it.
You got it, pal. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for the for Pennsylvania of the Laborers International Union of North America. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people come to talk.
And they're talking in the town square. It's a town where they're shouting. I hear them talking everywhere. They're talking in the sky. But all their words are whispering. Won't make you go away. The day they told
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. President Obama appeared on Zach Galifianakis' comedy show, Between Two Ferns, which airs on the website Funny or Die, to get the healthcare.gov message out to a younger audience.
If they get that health insurance, it can really make a big difference. And they've got till March 31st to sign up.
I don't have a computer, so how does...
Well, then you can call 1-800-318-2596.
Fox & Friends hosts Elizabeth Hasselbeck, Brian Kilmeade, and Peter Johnson Jr. had a different take on the interview.
Some would argue it's inappropriate for the President of the United States to be advertising a law, an insurance plan.
Well, the comedian was speaking truth to
in
power,
general.
Wasn't he? The whole thing is a big mock-up. I think it's pretty tragic.
Whoever
recommended that he do that show should be fired.
The conservative Washington Free Beacon described Anakis' interview with President Obama as, quote, just dreadful and gross. Next contributor and town hall editor Katie Pavlich's response to Obama's appearance on Funny or Die was a tweet saying, quote, I choose die. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Medical science has long known that the optic nerve runs from the retina of our eyeballs to the visual cortex of our brains, letting us see what's going on around us. Don't look now, but another optic nerve has evolved. Rather than running to our brains, however, this one goes outward, allowing others to see us and also hear us having what we assume to be private, even intimate, conversations. Those others are the out-of-control security agencies in England and the U.S. that are secretly vacuuming up everyone's communications, even though we're not suspected of any illegalities. The Brits took the lead in this latest visual intrusion, giving it the code name of optic nerve. They are tapping into the retinas of such Internet applications as Yahoo webcam chats, Google Hangouts, and Microsoft Skype. Millions of us have these services in our homes and offices, enabling us to have private video talks with someone or some group across town, or even around the world. Now we learn, though, that we're not alone. The spooks have hacked into the fiber optic networks of Yahoo and probably others to grab, view, listen to, and store millions of these personal communications. Creepy? Yes, Orwellian level creepy. As Yahoo put it, this represents a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. Lest you think the spies are only gathering info about terrorist plots, the British agency concedes that up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam images it has purloined contain sexually explicit content. One agent said of the mass window peeping, a surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking! Not that they would do that, but that you would be sneaking peeks at them.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance to bleed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I got this article from a couple of days ago, I guess over the weekend. One of these articles that make you go, political hack with an agenda, spewing talking points, without really thinking about their own situation. And I love these people because the article was evidently the Sentinel here in the area, which I think I now have a problem with, runs a column, Face of a Republican. I don't think they have a face of a Democrat. Or a face of a working person, or face of someone sane or rational, or face of common sense. I don't think they have any of that. I think they're a hack newspaper who has put this woman, who's willing to probably work for free. So that's probably the first part of this. And I'm sure she's paid, you know, by somebody, who knows who, because I went and I looked at the end of the article. It says how you contact this person, and the website, that the email address that gives is proudrepublicans.org, and it's password protected. And you go, am I missing something there? Something you want to be telling me? But I read this article under the face of a Republican that says, fairness, collection of union dues. And right away, you know this is going to be a hit piece. Right away, you know this is going to be a hack. It's going to be one of these people who... they had it pretty good growing up. And she starts right into it. She starts right in with, you know, the Union Plus website, which is a website that does Union Plus. They have credit cards and they have services. They're a service site that union members can go and get kind of deals for being a member or whatever. But she points out that the point of unions is increasing wages, raising the standard of living for the working class, ensuring safe working conditions, and increasing benefits for both workers and their families. Yeah, it is. And she goes on into saying her father, and I love these people, you know, the Pat Toomeys of the world. Her father was a maintenance and way employee, worked for the railroads, 42 years. And she admits her family reaped many benefits. Financial security, the power of that union got them things that they would have never gotten otherwise. And she throws that out there. She throws it right out there. She says, yeah, I know this. I know that the power of the union got my father a decent living and thus me food at the end of the month. Thus clothes on my back all year round. We live pretty well thanks to that union. And she admits that fully. That her father's work, the work that he did for 42 years, probably would not have been adequately compensated, or he wouldn't have been treated fairly. Completely from the beginning. So when you start with this point of view, this is what drives me nuts. When you start from this point of view, that I know this. I know my father's life would not have been what it was. Thus, my life would not have been what it was. I wouldn't have had the opportunities that I had because they had money. They had this. They had all this stuff to help me. I know this. But I'm going to badmouth it anyway because I'm a political hack. And she goes into them, because understand, think about this for a second, because I think this is vitally important. She says, this made my life better. Made my father's life better, my family's life better, made it better, adequately compensated, treated fairly, better wages, hours, conditions, all that stuff. Fully admits that right up front and then goes and says, well, it's just like a gym membership. because she says, you know, I've got a gym membership that just automatically taken out of my paycheck every month, and well, I shouldn't have to have that done. And when I realized that, you know, I've wasted all this money because I may go to the gym someday, I decided I wanted to spend that money differently. And I'm going, really? Is that what we've allowed in this country, that some political hack is going to equate the betterment of the working class, middle class wages, decent hours, decent wages, decent conditions to a gym membership, and that anyone would take her seriously? Understand what is. You have people like the Paul Ryans of the world, or this woman, whatever her name is, Teresa Myers, proudrepublican.org, who's spewing this nonsense that, you know, just like a gym membership. Now, her point that she wants to make, and she does it poorly, is that the state shouldn't be collecting dues for their employees. Again, you've got these people who say, we got to get government out of people's lives, wanting to have government interfere in the lives of worker-employee relations. Employer relations. I mean, it's pretty simple. This is something that people sit down and negotiate. But right now it's a Koch brother Republican Alec talking point that we need to neuter any opposition. And this is all this is. Understand, folks, at the end of this, all this is neutering the opposition. This is about cutting off the funding level for candidates that stand up for workers' rights, for minimum wage, for health care, for retirement security, for sick leaves, for the weekend. I mean, our weekend's being decimated. Most people moving forward are temporary. Most people are ending up in jobs that are freelance or independent contractors. Hey, you're your own boss. And you've got political hacks like this one wanting to destroy what little is left of that strong middle class that our grandparents' generation left for us. Now, she doesn't even know what the amount of money the state pays to collect those dues. Now, you got to wonder, if you're the gym owner who's collecting that 10 bucks a month, are you next? You got to wonder about the United Way. Are you next? How about the insurance companies? Are you next? Because if it's that onerous, if it's that expensive, it's that much trouble, well, we got to be going after them. Now, I've talked to the people who head up the public sector unions, and they say, we sit down, we negotiate this. And if the state would ever do a study to tell us how much it would cost, we'd be happy to pay it. But here's the thing, and this is the reality, and this is the end of the road on this. The reality is that it would cost more money to figure out how much it cost than it actually costs. And that's what political hacks like Ms. Myers doesn't seem to get. And what's grotesque on so many levels is this is somebody who has said, you know what? Those dreaded unions made my life better. All because her ideology tells her that's what she has to say. Without a thought. And the other part, the worst part about this is that there's a newspaper that would actually publish this trash. It just is what it is. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. Representatives George Miller and Joe Courtney have sent letters to fast food CEOs at McDonald's, Burger King,
Some brands, Wendy's and Papa John's, outlining the growing of their labor practices. The members of Congress want detailed information about the business models and labor practices at five of the nation's largest fast food companies. Representative Miller and Courtney say that the letters are the result of growing concern that the fast food labor practices are helping to drive up inequality, to stymie economic growth, and to strain state and local finances. Wage theft in the fast food industry is also an issue that the congressmen are concerned about. A Southern Union organizing effort is underway in Mobile, Alabama at the Austal USA shipyard. A business boom at the shipyard and a demand for highly skilled workers from around the country could be an organizing opportunity for unions. Ron Ault, president of the AFL-CIO's Metal Trades Department, told Working in These Times that the six unions in the department are banding together in an organizing campaign at Austal USA. The Australian-owned Austal is a contractor for the U.S. Navy. Austal is hostile to unions and uses anti-union meetings to instill fear in workers there. While the South is generally hostile to unions, a nearby shipyard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is union with 6,000 workers. The Legislative Conference of America's Building Trades Unions is underway in Washington. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey said in his keynote speech that the one impression he strives to leave with union members, building trades leaders, and heads of industry is that today's building trades unions are change agents that are about cooperation, not conflict. McGarvey says the building trades unions are about collaboration and not division. He says the building trades unions have strong and proud traditions and values about protecting the interests of their members, their families, and the American middle class. A mediation tentative labor agreement has been reached for 200 flight attendants at U.S. Airways Express. Piedmont Airlines flight attendants, represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the tentative agreement with management includes economic improvements, better work rules, and other benefits for the regional flight attendants. The union says Piedmont flight attendants stayed united to get to the agreement reached with the help of the National Mediation Board. The ratification vote for the flight attendants starts March 17th, and runs through April 9th. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research looks at the rights and limitations on public sector collective bargaining in the 50 U.S. states. The report focuses on teachers, police, and firefighters. It examines whether the workers have the right to bargain collectively, whether that right includes the ability to bargain over wages, and whether public sector workers have the right to strike.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
The best argument, by far the best argument we could possibly ever make. For Royal Dutch Shell to build their cracker plant in western Pennsylvania is free markets. I love that. That's such nice rhetoric, don't you think? It's not the $1.7 billion sweetener. No, it's this ideological belief in free markets. Yes, that's what it is. It's not the free money. No, that's just a present. It's because we're nice, right? And I've been saying for years, one of the things that has to happen in this country, not just here in Pennsylvania or with Ohio or West Virginia, across the country, is we need to be stopping this beggar thy neighbor economic development. We need to stop pursuing policies that say, hey, we'll pass right to work for less so we can steal jobs from our neighbors. And maybe start thinking in a way that raises up the working conditions and the living conditions for everyone. So the other day, the folks over at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center held a press conference with a number of groups from Ohio and West Virginia to talk about how do we stop this beggar thy neighbor economic development? How do we not give $1.7 billion in handouts for the next quarter of a century? That's why we've asked Wendy Patton, Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio, to come talk to us about the press conference and, you know, what idea we have to go forward. Wendy, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
You know, one of my rage moments has been, you know, you look at these huge handouts we give to these big companies to move across the street, and just because across the street's in another state, they get huge windfalls of cash where same workers, same jobs, nothing new comes of it, just a whole lot of my money, your money, and my kids' future going across the street.
There's a lot more that unites us than divides us, and this
harmful competition that you describe, Rick, divides us in a way that's bad for each one of our states. That's why Pennsylvania's Budget and Policy Center, West Virginia's Center on Budget Policy and Policy Matters Ohio got together yesterday to approach the governors of our three states and ask them to please cooperate on a single tax rate for severance tax rate for oil and gas, so that we wouldn't be playing our states off against one another, trying to see who can get the most wells, who can tax the lowest, who can provide the least in terms of critical public services. What we actually need is to build our communities, especially in drilling regions, to provide for the needs, the external costs of production, and to build for a better future after the oil and gas boom has gone bust. And
right.
We need that across the region, not just in Ohio, not just in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. We need it across the region. It's more that unites us than divides us.
I'm right there with you. And, you know, for years, since this whole, I don't even know what to call it, impact fee, I think is what they call it. It's not an extraction tax. It's some weird little calculation. And I've said, you know, the weird thing about it is, you know, we're actually pulling West Virginia down. And, you know, think what you want. I mean, you know, when you look at national studies on rankings of states of misery indexes, West Virginia is generally near the bottom, and we're actually making their conditions even worse. And I think that speaks a lot about the leadership of our state, not just here in Pennsylvania, but in other states as well.
Draining the resources from West Virginia does nothing to help the larger Pennsylvania or Midwestern economy. In a global economy, we boost the fortunes of our employers, our manufacturers, only by the strength of our market. And if we're pulling down wages and pulling down critical services that help communities get ahead next door, we're actually damaging the prospects for our companies within our own state. So it's ultimately a self-defeating approach to compete on the low road of economic development. We really need to get on the high road. We need to set sensible tax rates that are not too high across any state, that actually meet the needs for reinvestment and do not drag each other down, instead build up the whole region.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, I've often said there should be a floor. And not, you know, like the West Virginia, and I like the, how I forget who said it with one of your groups, where the West Virginia tax should be the floor, not the ceiling, where we should be looking at, you know, maybe raising everyone's up a little bit so you have better schools, better environmental protection, better enforcement of regulation, things like that, instead of this race to the bottom that we've been pursuing for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. So the question that I have is, you know, in looking at this, this kind of makes me go, well, couldn't at some level the states be sued for some type of collusion by the drillers? Because we've given them so much power. I fear that, you know, they're above state control at this point, and maybe even above federal control.
That is a very scary thought. I think that the dangers about how states operate together, though, are tightly regulated under interstate commerce laws, and this would not be in violation of interstate commerce laws if states were to cooperate on setting an adequate tax rate across the boundaries. We did look at West Virginia as establishing a floor for a sensible severance tax rate, because really West Virginia is the only one of our three states that has a conventional self-respecting severance tax. Pennsylvania has its impact fee, which is a local fee based on market prices, where the monies go to local governments that choose to enact it. Ohio has a volume-based fee, a very low rate, and it's really a much older model of taxation for natural resources, because Ohio's oil collections, after all, peaked in the late 1800s. It's a very old industry in Ohio. So our tax system is not modern. Really, we look to West Virginia as having a decent, modern, and adequate tax rate that that can provide a floor on which we could build to meet the needs of our communities. And the needs of our communities, especially in the impacted areas, are very high. There's two issues with the severance tax that really take some fancy footwork in public finance configuration. One is that the initial needs of communities associated with drilling are very high. You need strong bridges, you need widened roads, you need adequate water treatment plants. These costs can be very high. Yep. Luckily, the natural resources can provide the resources that you need to address those. But the resources can sometimes come in like a fire hose and destabilize the public finances of a village. So really, it's a state and local joint effort to control and direct these revenues where they're needed and at the time they're needed.
That's an excellent point. I mean, and I look at Pennsylvania, who, you know, we had an oil boom, or we had a coal boom. You would think that we would learn the lessons from those past booms and the busts that came with them, and the destruction and the degradation and the environmental catastrophes that came with them. And then you try and mitigate that on some level looking forward. To me, it looks like the people who are running our state government, I'm sure the people in Ohio are not much better. I don't think that they're looking for that. I mean, we keep hearing, oh, you want to kill the golden goose. No, I want to make sure that I'm not killed by the golden goose.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's amazing how our states really are pretty sophisticated places with big universities. We provide advice to the rest of the world on all kinds of business and public finance topics. We know how to mitigate these dangers. We know how to regulate industries, but we don't. So there is a political problem out there, and I think it takes the voice of the people to turn this around. I think people need to start talking to their legislators about what's going on in their classroom. How many of their kids have to pay to play sports these days? What do those potholes look like on the street? Unless the people speak up about the needs of their communities, legislators are going to listen to louder voices.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing that gets me, though, Wendy, is, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. When I was a kid, the Lake Erie was basically dead. We were allowed nowhere near the lake. And when I look at the pollution, when I look at the environmental costs of not adequately regulating from the start, I remember those. I remember as a kid suffering horribly from asthma. I remember the bad air. I remember the bad water. And you go, do we have to keep reliving these cycles over and over and over again?
Yeah, we actually don't have to keep living them over again. We know what they've done to us before. And our centers of knowledge and power, our universities, have experts that advise all kinds of different countries in how to deal with these problems.
Yeah.
We certainly should be, and with the help of active citizens who don't want their kids to have asthma and don't believe it's right that their kids should have to pay to play sports while the oil companies are paying ridiculously low severance tax rates, people need to speak up and become active about this issue.
I agree. But you know what the drillers are paying? Lots of campaign donations, especially to a governor, like $1 million to the governor here in Pennsylvania. And I'm sure that his coffers will be full in this next election. And I don't know that Kasich would probably be any different in Ohio. So, you know, I know you guys sent letters to the governors. What kind of response have you gotten back?
Well, we haven't gotten a response yet, but we will keep asking. We want to meet with the governors and the governor's staff, and we hope to have a session in the tri-state area in which we'd like to have the governors come and meet with interested citizens and local elected officials and representatives throughout the area to discuss what are the needs and how do we address them. We're very hopeful. I wouldn't say we're optimistic in Ohio that will happen, but we're hopeful. After all, the governor is our elected leader. We expect him to listen to the voices of all people. We think we have a good argument to make, and we hope that he listens to our request.
Yeah, good luck on that one.
Thank you.
The guy who said, if you working people, if you don't get on my bus, I'm going to run you over, as he was passing SB5. Which fortunately the bus ran him over, but you know, good luck on that, because I think at the end of it he's just got to go like our governor. So I'm hopeful for that. You're listening. The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Wendy Patton. She's Senior Project Director at the at Policy Matters Ohio. Their website, policymattersohio.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Wendy's name. Take you right there. So how do we... I think what's happened on the left, so to speak, of the political divide, people, you've got the two camps. You've got people like me who, cognizant of the fact we're not going to stop it. The train is kind of left. I would like to see it slow down. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm more of the mindset that we need to heavily regulate. We need to pay attention and hold people accountable when bad things happen. How do you bridge that divide of where your power base would be of the people who are just adamantly opposed to it happening, and then people who are you know more pragmatic who go, well, it's going to happen. We should be regulating it. How do we bridge that?
You know, I hate to say this, but events like what happened in Charleston with the environmental damage in the river there.
The Freedom Water!
That can move people. There was an earthquake in Youngstown yesterday, another one, which have been found to be associated in that part of the state with the waste disposal associated with fracking. I wish that it were easier than saying people get, when they are shaken up, when they feel that their water is not clean, when they see the cracks in their walls, they seek solutions. It meant that kind of impact to actually move people. You would hope that it would move people, that people would become active and start talking to their legislators about this before the crisis, but sometimes I think it takes the crisis for it to happen. So we are, yesterday, even as we gave our, had our press call, Representative Bob Hagan said, you know, I've just been on the phone with the EPA. There's another earthquake here in Youngstown. There are real impacts to this growing industry on our property values, on our safety, on our communities. We're very hopeful across the state that this is a very positive impact, but the industry has been growing much more slowly than it's been hyped to grow or than has been promised. And some of these other problems are emerging. So I wouldn't say we expect to see this tomorrow, but I'm hoping as the realization dawns that this is a slow process and there is a downside for some communities in terms of property values and development, that people really take matters into their own hands and seek solutions before the damage is done.
And I'm right there with you. And join groups to get involved with groups like yours at Policy Matters Ohio and others across the country. Last question I've got for you. Let's say there's somebody out there and they want to get involved. They want to help. What's the first thing they should be doing?
Well, they should look within their own community. Virtually every community has groups that are beginning to bring people together to talk about the environmental situation and the job situation in their communities. Many of these groups are faith-based. You can look to the churches. Many of the groups are labor-based. If you're in a union, you could see what involvement your union locally has in these kinds of discussions. Now, if you're in Pennsylvania, you can go to the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center website, see what they've written and who they are sort of in conversations with on their blog and other places. If you live in Ohio, something that I found out through going to the testimony in the hearings on regional severance tax legislation is that there are many organizations in eastern Ohio seriously considering the issues we've discussed tonight. These are local planning organizations, regional planning organizations. At city council, these issues are discussed. Citizens can simply get involved in the civic life of their own communities. And this discussion is going on every week in communities all across the drilling areas. If you're in West Virginia, look at the website of Ted Bettner's West Virginia Policy Center on Budget and Policy and see who's active there and who's participating. There is a robust conversation going on at the local level, and you can start in your own community. See what people are thinking and saying and seek out people. people who want the same kind of results you want.
Just basic organizing. Talk to your friends. Talk to your neighbors. Don't stay on the couch.
That's absolutely right. You know, what you said about growing up in the west side of Cleveland, when I spoke to my friends in civil engineering about some of the problems that I see around water with the horizontal drilling, the answer I got back was that, you put enough water down a hole, it comes up eventually.
Yep.
So we have to be very vigilant about regulation, about oversight, about monitoring, about the physical condition of our community. That takes money. And so this is why having an adequate severance tax to help us monitor the situation out there, as well as to help us build the roads we need, mitigate the congestion, and deal with other health concerns, is something we have to work on.
And it's stuff we have to demand of our leadership. Wendy Patton, I appreciate you taking time for us. Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio. Of course, their website, policymattersohio.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Wendy, thanks so much for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
Wendy Patton, thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8-hour 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
No, can't give up the fight. That's really what this is all about. It's about what the fight for what the future is going to look like. The future, and I was talking to Wendy there. You know, I'm thinking about being, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the projects there, near Lake Erie. We went to the lake, you know, fairly often to throw stuff in, but we were never jumped in there. It was brown. It was nasty. The only fish you saw were floating sideways, one eye up. Yeah, that's, to me, that's the sad reality of what we've allowed the corporatists to do. Now, look, can you do these things safely? I think so. And with limited environmental destruction, look, you're never going to do anything perfectly that's not going to cause some damage. And I know there are those who say, well, if you can't do it without any, you can't do it. Well, that's just never going to be reality. And while I don't like it, it just is what it is. And especially as we're continually given these false choices. We get them quite often, don't we? Well, if we don't have this, no jobs. We'll be standing around looking at each other. Nobody will do anything. Which is ludicrous. But it's the extremes that they throw to us, isn't it? So I think it's an interesting idea that we should be creating regions, maybe, where, because you got to stop this beggar thy neighbor economic development. You just, at some level, it has to stop. It has to stop where we're giving our kids' future away to these corporate special interests who, you know, just walk away. And for me, the severance tax, just mind-blowing that Republicans have gotten away with this. That they've gotten away with not taxing the drillers. And, you know, as I've said, you know, Alaska's quite happy to dish out checks. And Sarah Palin was one of them who was dishing out the checks from the oil industry through a tax. A tax that you and me and every other person who buys oil pays. So why wouldn't you do the same thing with the gas that we're pulling out from under our feet? It's very odd to me. But, you know, it's the poison that's pushed upon us. Anyway, coming out of the CPAC conference, Ted Cruz is trying to kiss up and make nice with Rand Paul, and evidently Rand's not having anything of it. Paul criticized Cruz, and Cruz criticized him, and blah, 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 and they went back and forth. And, you know, it came out that Cruz had said something about, you know, being like Ronald Reagan, Rand Paul came out and said, well, read up on Ronald Reagan because he's not Reagan enough and I'm more Reagan than he is. And I find it very interesting that the party of extremists is trying to say that, hey, I'm the Reagan guy, when neither of them are the Reagan guys. I mean, really, you look at this, and Reagan was for his time, the extremist, and maybe that's where they're looking at it, saying, I'm the Reagan of my time because I'm far out and extreme. But I just find it very interesting that they're still, you know, I'm the Reagan guy. Why not say I'm the Lincoln guy or I'm the Roosevelt guy or just very odd. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast that you're on the smartphone. Email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. And I do answer all emails personally. Quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. Representatives George Miller and Joe Courtney have sent letters to fast food CEOs at McDonald's, Burger King, Yum Brands, Wendy's, and Papa John's, outlining the growing concerns about their labor practices. The members of Congress want detailed information about the business models and labor practices at five of the nation's largest fast food companies. Representative Miller and Courtney say that the letters are the result of growing concern that the fast food labor practices are helping to drive up inequality, to stymie economic growth, and to strain state and local finances. Wage theft in the fast food industry is also an issue that the congressmen are concerned about. A Southern Union organizing effort is underway in Mobile, Alabama, at the Austal USA shipyard. A business boom at the shipyard and a demand for highly skilled workers from around the country could be an organizing opportunity for unions. Ron Ault, president of the AFL-CIO's Metal Trades Department, told Working in These Times that the six unions in the department are banding together in an organizing campaign at Austal USA. The Australian-owned Austal is a contractor for the U.S. Navy. Austal is hostile to unions and uses anti-union meetings to instill fear in workers there. While the South is generally hostile to unions, a nearby shipyard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is union with 6,000 workers.
The Legislative Conference of America's Building Trades Unions is underway in Washington. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey said in his keynote speech that the one impression he strives to leave with union members, building trades leaders, and heads of industry is that today's building trades unions are change agents that are about cooperation, not conflict. McGarvey says the building trades unions are about collaboration and not division. He says the building trades unions have strong and proud traditions and values about protecting the interests of their members, their families, and the American middle class. A mediation tentative labor agreement has been reached for 200 flight attendants at U.S. Airways Express. Piedmont Airlines flight attendants, represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the tentative agreement with management includes economic improvements, better work rules, and other benefits for the regional flight attendants. The union says Piedmont flight attendants stayed united to get to the agreement reached with the help of the National Mediation Board. The ratification vote for the flight attendants starts March 17th and runs through April 9th. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research looks at the rights and limitations on public sector collective bargaining in the 50 U.S. states. The report focuses on teachers, police, and firefighters. It examines whether the workers have the right to bargain collectively, whether that right includes the ability to bargain over wages, and whether public sector workers have the right to strike.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're going to WIN, Workers Independent News.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I came across this article that caught my attention. And again, anytime someone from the Heritage Foundation is telling me that, oh, I've got the answer, we can easily just, you know, give workers a voice without those union things, I get kind of questioning. You kind of got to go, exactly what are you talking about? And when the corporatists are telling us that they care about us, I think it's really time to start worrying, which is why I've asked our good friend John Logan, professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, to come talk to us. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, glad to be on, Rick.
So I look at this story in the Atlantic of this guy from the Heritage Foundation saying, oh, well, you know, that American labor law is just too onerous, and well, we should be allowing companies to set up unions again, or whatever is. I'm still trying to figure out what his argument is, other than unions are bad.
Right. Yeah. As you said, you know, whenever someone from the Heritage Foundation said, you know, they know the answer in terms of what workers want, you should immediately be suspicious. And that's certainly the case here. I mean, it's a really fundamentally dishonest piece. It's saying that, you know, we need to change the law to get rid of the prohibition of company unions, because it would allow forms of employee voice, such as works councils, that employees actually want and that companies want. But the whole premise of the article is that it's completely dishonest. First of all, it says that workers at Volkswagen rejected the union because, faced with the choice of the UAW or nothing at all, they preferred nothing at all. And we know that that's not the case. I mean, you know, this election, which is still under dispute and has been appealed to the National Labor Relations Board, you know, let us remember, the reason that, you know, they decided by the slimmest majorities to vote against the UAW was because they were lied to and intimidated by Republican politicians and by right-wing groups with connections to Grover Norquist and all of the other, you know, anti-union billionaires. And second of all, this article, Shirk from the Heritage Foundation, you know, he doesn't want works councils. What he wants is to make it more difficult for workers, to join genuine unions. And, you know, so he uses this case from the 1990s. There was a couple of cases in the early 1990s, in which the board decided against company unions, And he sort of says that this put a chill on the whole thing, and you know, and that, you know, ever since then, your employers have been frightened to have any kind of experimentation with employee voice because the NLRB were really against them.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah, it's complete nonsense. I mean, you know, he gives you a completely distorted and again, really dishonest history of what's happened. You know, he doesn't actually tell you that it was the Bush NLRB, that you know, the Bush senior NLRB, that made these decisions, and it was certainly no friend of unions. And you know, this was not these were not programs that involved any kind of team working or employee involvement or any kind of innovative forms of employee voice. These were old-fashioned company unions in these two cases that he talks about. And so, you know, really what he's doing is calling for a reform of the law that would allow employers who do face union organizing campaigns to set up fake unions and to pressure employees into joining those as opposed to joining real unions. And you know, there is a case for reforming the law to make various forms of employee voice more accessible, but certainly in return for relaxing the prohibition of company unions, you've got to offer far greater protections for forms real unions, because you know we know that the problem with the law as it currently stands is not that it's difficult for employers to set up these employee involvement committees. They do it all the time, all over the country, every day. The problem with the law is that it's so difficult for workers who want a real union to get one. And, you know, he refuses to acknowledge that, of course, because it doesn't sort of fit in with the ideological mindset and the worldview of the Heritage Foundation. But, you know, that's the fundamental problem with the law as it stands.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, you've mentioned this thing, company unions, and I honestly believe the vast majority of Americans have no idea what a company union actually is, other than from my standpoint, if I were somebody, I'd go, well, that doesn't sound very good. How can it be good for us? Can you quick explain what exactly, in the eyes of the law, you view as a company union?
Well, the reason that we have this very clear prohibition of employer-dominated labor organizations, Section 882, you know, is the part of the National Labor Relations Act, is that When employees first gained the right to organize in the 1930s, before the passage of the Wagner Act after the National Industrial Recovery Act, employers all across the country set up these fake unions to try and pressure them into these unions instead of into real unions. And so then we had the Wagner Act saying, no, workers have the right to form real unions, and they got to be unions of their own choosing. They can't be these fake unions that are controlled by employers, which give workers no real bargaining power, no real voice, that are completely under the control of management. And, you know, over the years, what has happened, as I said, is in the absence of an aggrieved union, you know, in the absence of a workplace in which a union is actively trying to organize, the truth is that employers are able to do all sorts of stuff that probably do violate the prohibition of company unions. But, you know, no one really cares that much unless workers are actually trying to join a genuine union. And, you know, we had this debate in the early 90s under the Clinton administration. He set up the Dunlop Commission when Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor. And, you know, the idea was that, you know, that John Dunlop, you know, who was the country's leading negotiator, thought that he could strike a deal between unions and employers in that he would relax the prohibition of company unions, which is supposedly what employers wanted, and in return they would give unions greater protection for workers' right to organize. But it became very, very clear that employers didn't really want it, and there was nothing that they wanted that would allow them to accept that workers had a stronger right to organize. That, you know, blocking workers' right to organize was the most important thing, and, you know, it trumped everything else. And they didn't care about, you know, the prohibition of company unions. You know, they came out, you know, a couple of years later with this phony TEAM Act, which right. would have legalized company unions, which Clinton eventually vetoed. But you know, the truth is that employers are actually quite happy with the status quo because they dominate the system. You know, they have a stranglehold over the system of union representation. You know, they can defeat, you know, because of, you know, the system is so stacked, you know, heavily in the favor of employers who are hostile to unions. They just want to keep that. And, you know, all of this other stuff is just a distraction. You know, so Scher brings up all of this stuff saying that, you know, the time has come to revisit this issue and see if we need to relax the prohibition of company unions. It's all nonsense, and it's really just, you know, a smokescreen, a red herring designed to distract from the real issue, which is that workers no longer have a genuine right to organize.
And, you know, you look at, and part of me looks at this as preemption by the corporatist class. They realize that people are getting a little antsy. I mean, wages have
right.
been stagnant and declining for the better part of three decades now. I mean, when I first started working, I was throwing boxes on a shipping dock back in 1988, making $15 an hour. The people today, right now,
right.
this day, right across down the road, doing the exact same job for 12.
Yeah,
so, you
yeah.
know, in this span of time, some 29 years, the wages have gone down.
Right. And that's the real issue. I mean, you're absolutely right. That's the real issue. You know, some people say that, you know, the crisis in worker voice is so severe, you know, because unions represent such a small percentage of the private sector workforce that, you know, unions have to be replaced by something. You know, unions aren't going to rebound anytime soon, and so we need to sort of, like, come up with these other forms of employee voice. But the truth is, if you know, the whole system does explode, it's not going to be over issues of works councils. I mean, works councils are perfectly good, and then Volkswagen, you know, which operates works councils all over the world, but also operates unions all over the world outside of Tennessee, which he also doesn't mention in the article. The works councils aren't going to be the issue. The issue is that people just don't have enough to live on.
Yep.
You know, I mean, that's going to be the issue that, you know, is sort of like driving, like, you know, the sort of next up surge, you know, if and when that were to happen, not because of, like, you know, any sort of, like, you know, phony conservative issue about employee involvement at the workplace. You know, a worker's voice is always a good thing, but it's got to be a genuine voice, and it's got to be a voice that leads to an end to poverty wages and to real benefits and to sort of a genuine voice at the workplace, not these fake kinds of voice that the conservatives and the Heritage Foundation like to talk about and promote.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw it, I'm going, wow, that's so nice of you to care about us poor lowly working people and give us a throwback to the good old days of the 80s and 90s.
Right.
The 1880s and 1890s.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly what I mean. Basically, you know, asking for a return, you know, maybe to the 1880s, 1890s, certainly to the 1920s. I mean, that's, you know, how he sort of sees the situation today. You know, the unions are as weak as they were in the 1920s. You know, we got to offer them something that makes it look like, you know, that workers are actually having some input when in reality they have none whatsoever. But you know, I mean, people see through it. I mean, you know,
I hope.
People. Yeah. Well, you know, people are, you know, it's as you said, it's a desperate time for many people, and, you know, they're unorganized and they're often, you know, feeling quite powerless. But I think that, you know, few people are duped by these sort of like phony schemes that, you know, the right, you know, as you say, I mean, we can only hope, but, you know, the same people who are promoting all of the anti-union initiatives at the state level, you know, the right to work, the paycheck protection, you know, in Pennsylvania and in other states, in Missouri and elsewhere, they're exactly the same ones who are, you know, were fighting against the UAW at Volkswagen and, you know, all of these state groups linked to the Heritage Foundation. And, you know, it's the Heritage Foundation that's promoting this sort of idea of, you know, phony employee voice at the workplaces as opposed to real voice.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, the thing that gets me is, you know, you've got all these Koch brothers, all this money that's going into all of this messaging. And I personally wish labor had the power and the influence that they're trying to convince people that they do. And that the reason they need to be crushed because they have all of this power and control. Let me ask you, you brought up work councils a couple of times, and so a different concept here in the U.S. And I've often asked, you know, how would that, let's say that would have passed, how would that have worked into U.S. law?
Right.
Is it something that would kind of, just curious.
It could have worked fine at Volkswagen, you know, if, you know, the workers had been given a free choice and if they'd got the union that, you know, clearly a majority wanted before, you know, you had this sort of like right-wing roadshow descend on Tennessee and on Chattanooga. Once the union is recognized, there's nothing to say that within the plant you have to have a shop steward system. There's nothing to say that the union and management cannot agree to delegate some powers to the works council at the plant level. So, you know, the union, the UAW and Volkswagen, would still negotiate over pay and benefits, but at the level of, you know, the shop floor, you could have the works council that was dealing with issues of employee welfare, that's dealing with issues of flexibility and time scheduling, that's dealing with issues in work organization. And that's what happens in Germany. You know, I mean, you have like this, you have different layers of genuine worker voice. You know, you have the works council at the plant level. You have, collective bargaining between IG Metall and the employers groups at the sectoral level, and then you also have the system of co-determination, and you have worker directives on the board of management. So there's nothing in U.S. law that would have prohibited that system once the union had been recognized, if we had got that, and we may still get it, I think, the right thing for the National Labor Relations Board to do is to overturn the tainted election. Because if they don't, what happened, the outrageous abuses that happened in Chattanooga will just become the norm for union elections, particularly in the South. At Nissan in Mississippi and at Mercedes in Alabama. And, just the way that the Kochs and the groups connected to Norquist try to buy political elections will be trying to buy union elections as well. It won't matter even if you have, an employer like Volkswagen who says and who genuinely did respect workers' right to choose. You'll still have these other groups third-party groups interfering and trying to intimidate and to pressure the workers from the outside. And if it had worked, the workers had, been given a free choice, at Volkswagen and we had got the union and got the works council, it may have, put some pressure or at least, influenced, companies like Mercedes and, BMW in South Carolina and others to do the same. So in that sense, the Works Council is a perfectly good idea, works well, for Europe, in conjunction with unions. So as I say, another, infuriating and completely dishonest thing about that article is that he talks about how, Volkswagen, they recognize the importance of employee involvement. They have works councils all over the world, but they also have unions all over the world. Yep. He doesn't tell you this, and so they recognize the value of unions as well as the value of works councils. And if the two go together, it's Volkswagen.
Yeah, I mean, I liked how he finished it off attacking the NLRB for not allowing those works councils, because those are good. It's the unions that are bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I found very, very disingenuous and fallacious at best.
Absolutely. And as I said, he starts off by talking about this one NLRB decision, which was actually a Bush senior NLRB decision. And it was a clear-cut decision because this, was an old-fashioned company union, and this company has fought an organizing campaign by the workers for years, and there was no question that, that their company union was in violation of the law. It's a completely dishonest piece. I mean, it's very disappointing that, it's in the Atlantic as opposed to on the Heritage Foundation website, which is, would be a more appropriate site for, yep, for right-wing propaganda like that.
And that's where it caught my attention. And to me, I put this not quite as high as Paul Ryan recently saying that if kids have to get school lunches, their parents don't love them. But it's close.
Yeah. No, it's, as you say, fundamentally dishonest. And, you know, just trying to distract attention from the real issues, from the real issue of right-wing interference, outside right-wing interference with the Volkswagen, and from the real issue that you know, workers no longer have a genuine right to form a union in this country. They have it on paper, but it's increasingly almost impossible to exercise in practice.
Yeah, especially when you got billionaires throwing money at it.
Yeah.
And this is going to be the new model, I guess. John, it's always great talking to you. I appreciate you taking time for us and giving us your insight on this.
Happy to be on, Rick.
Thanks so much. Always great talking with you. John Logan, Professor and Director of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13. Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Medical science has long known that the optic nerve runs from the retina of our eyeballs to the visual cortex of our brains, letting us see what's going on around us. Don't look now, but another optic nerve has evolved. Rather than running to our brains, however, this one goes outward, allowing others to see us and also hear us having what we assume to be private, even intimate, conversations. Those others are the out-of-control security agencies in England and the U.S., that are secretly vacuuming up everyone's communications, even though we're not suspected of any illegalities. The Brits took the lead in this latest visual intrusion, giving it the code name of optic nerve. They're tapping into the retinas of such internet applications as Yahoo webcam chats, Google Hangouts, and Microsoft Skype. Millions of us have these services in our homes and offices, enabling us to have private video talks with someone or some group across town, or even around the world. Now we learn, though, that we're not alone. The spooks have hacked into the fiber optic networks of Yahoo, and probably others, to grab, view, listen to, and store millions of these personal communications. Creepy? Yes, Orwellian level creepy. As Yahoo put it, this represents a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. Lest you think the spies are only gathering info about terrorist plots, the British agency concedes that up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam images it has purloined contain sexually explicit content. One agent said of the mass window peeping, "A surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person." This is Jim Hightower saying, "How shocking! Not that they would do that, but that you would be sneaking peeks at them."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Anyway,
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. During the break, I got an email from John who points out, in 2010, Germany actually produced almost twice as many cars as, as we did in the U.S. He says they Germany produced 5.5 million automobiles and the U.S. produced 2.7 million automobiles in the year of 2010. And while this is going on, the average salary for a auto worker in Germany was $67.14 an hour. In salary and benefits. In the U.S., the average U.S. auto worker made $33.77. And then you go, but Rick, no, you're wrong. I heard on fake news that they make $72 an hour. And you go, no, that's not true. That's throwing in retiree health care. And everything else that they could throw into the labor costs and then divided by a gross number. That was a made-up, fallacious number. Again, another lie. And, you know, as I've made it my personal goal. If I can do nothing else, I'm going to convince my aunt, who gets these emails of all of these, very reasonable-sounding issues and very focus-group-tested, think-tank-approved, Heritage Foundation-type stuff that just sounds, why can't employers talk to their workers? Last time I checked, they can. What they can't do is make them think that they have some type of representation provided to them by the employer. That's where we start getting into this territory of company work unions. If you have a meeting, call it what you want, a safety meeting, a production meeting, whatever, and you say, how can we help? How can we do things better? Ergonomics committee. There's nothing illegal about that. But this is what the Heritage Foundation people want you to think. It's illegal. You can't talk to your workers. That's against the law. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. But it's what they like to ram down our throats. And, you look at these very profitable companies in Germany. And how is it that they're able to pay their employees such higher wages? And not just the auto workers, but the feeder plants, all of the stuff that goes into it. And I remember this article, some time ago. I can't quite remember the name of it. Something like remapping the debate or something, written by a guy named Kevin Brown. I do remember that. Who basically said, look, the reason that the German auto companies are able to pay decent wages, the reason that they're able to have these work councils that take worker advisement into account is because they don't do this race to the bottom stuff. They don't put each other in cutthroat competition. And, this is what unions of the past were able to do. One of the goals one of labor's goals of the past, when they had a good, solid union density of 35%, when they controlled, I take what I know, as someone who worked in the trucking industry for 20 years. I worked in the LTL trucking sector, which is a sector of the trucking industry. When I first started, it was about 80%. Unionized, which meant that if you got you lost this job, you went across the street, you worked at another job, made the same wages. So the industry had a floor. And what they did is they took wages and benefits out of the equation, and the competition was based on who made the best widget, who handled the freight in the freight industry the best, who delivered on time, who had the best, the best people, all of that. You competed based on positive things, not who's willing to have their children go hungry tomorrow. And that's something I think as a nation we have really, really forgotten. This race to the bottom, cutthroat competition of hooray for me and the heck with everyone else has destroyed not only a massive middle class, but the opportunity to get to that middle class. And to me, that's what's really, really infuriating. Because as you pay attention to this stuff, as you look at what's going on and go, hey, we got problems here, there's no alternative to get back to it. And when you see articles like this Shirk Art Guys article from the Heritage Foundation, one of these right-wing corporatist think tanks, not even really think tanks, I mean, they're just peddling propaganda. It's what it is. When you see this, though, you've got to ask the question, to whose benefit? Cui bono? To who benefits? To whose advantage? Do you really think the people at the Heritage Foundation have found this newfound caring for people working at the local fast food joint? Do you think they've really found some caring for the guy driving the 18-wheeler down the road? No! They know who's putting bread on their table. They know who's funding their tinky tanks. They know who's filling the coffers of their enterprise. And if it means peddling some propaganda, if it means pushing this poison down on people who go, oh, it sounds plausible. That email sounded about right. Let me click that right on through. Then they're going to do that. And if it means your working conditions get worse, if it means your family's living gets worse, so be it. And then what we'll do is we'll demonize people who need help. If your kid needs a school lunch, it's because you don't love them enough. I mean, every person in this country should be outraged that a sitting politician would have the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to say something like that. But, you know, the response I got from people, well, I could see that. Really? I guess, what does that say about us? And at the end of the day, as we look at what's going on, as we look at the situation in Tennessee, and I hope the NLRB comes around with the right decision, which is to make them vote again and to hold people accountable for getting involved in it. And I hope the people in Tennessee will say, hey, you know what? If those billionaires are spending money on billboards and on really slick looking web pages and on tons of flyers and sending people from all over the country in here to tell us, you don't need that, we better damn well get it. And we better fight for it so we can keep it. Because that's what the right is afraid of, be it health care, be it unions, be it anything. Once people take on to it and they take ownership of it, it's ours. The right knows they're never going to be able to steal it back. They've got to convince us somehow bad for us. Somehow that responsibility of having a voice, somehow bad for us. Seems kind of weird, doesn't it? At least it does to me. Anyway, gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Medical science has long known that the optic nerve runs from the retina of our eyeballs to the visual cortex of our brains, letting us see what's going on around us. Don't look now, but another optic nerve has evolved. Rather than running to our brains, however, this one goes outward, allowing others to see us and also hear us having what we assume to be private, even intimate, conversations. Those others are the out-of-control security agencies in England and the U.S. that are secretly vacuuming up everyone's communications, even though we're not suspected of any illegalities. The Brits took the lead in this latest visual intrusion, giving it the code name of optic nerve. They are tapping into the retinas of such Internet applications as Yahoo webcam chats, Google Hangouts, and Microsoft Skype. Millions of us have these services in our homes and offices, enabling us to have private video talks with someone or some group across town, or even around the world. Now we learn, though, that we're not alone. The spooks have hacked into the fiber optic networks of Yahoo and probably others to grab, view, listen to, and store millions of these personal communications. Creepy? Yes, Orwellian level creepy. As Yahoo put it, this represents a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. Lest you think the spies are only gathering info about terrorist plots, the British agency concedes that up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam images it has purloined contain sexually explicit content. One agent said of the mass window peeping, "A surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person." This is Jim Hightower saying, "How shocking! Not that they would do that, but that you would be sneaking peeks at them."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, yes, I was kind of, you know, peering around at the fake news on Fox and, you know, came across this clip that, again, caught my attention. Another one that you go, well, that's unusual, but not for fake news at Fox. Evidently, you know, what was going on is one of the other programs was talking to the two idiots on Fox and Friends, and they made a comparison between what's going on in Crimea to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, of course, you know, because you got to make Obama look bad, got to make him look like all he's doing is out, playing around. Kilmeade, one of the guys who I think just needs to get smacked, said also JFK didn't go golfing during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president was. And I also heard he went to the bathroom once, maybe twice, since all this broke. Just nuts to me. And what's interesting is we're going to compare what's going on in Crimea to the Cuban Missile? Really? We have really gone kind of off the deep end, don't you think? Anyway, here to help us figure out what's going on in Washington, D.C., around the world, Bob May, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what do you think? Is there an accurate comparison between what's going on over in the Ukraine and the Cuban Missile Crisis? I mean, are we a blink of the eye away from extinction now?
Well, you know, the president can't win with certain people. He does one of the most fantastic things in three decades of actually getting Iran to talk about contains nuclear capability. And, of course, then, he's helping to create a nuclear war. And then comparing this to the missile crisis, I mean, look, Russia, Europe, there's Europe and Russia, and Crimea is in between. That's the buffer zone.
Yep.
So if it rises to the level, which there are not nukes pointed, but if it rises to the level of something that's important, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be concerned about it, but it is not in our backyard. And how they're trying to relate this is beyond me. This is not, you know, John McCain was saying, you know, we need to do something in the military, we're weak. What are we going to do? Make 1,000 more nukes?
Yes.
And tell Russia, you know, you invade, we're going to send one? I mean, this is silly. It will go away. I don't think people believe that whatsoever about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Crimea.
But don't you think, you know, on some level you've got the war hawks who you always have among you really out there pounding the drum because the budgets have scaled back a little bit on defense spending. I mean, you know, when you had Hagel come out recently and say that we're going to have troop numbers lower than we had before World War II, even though the whole concept of war has completely changed since World War II. We do more things with video games than we do with people on the ground. But don't you think a lot of that had to do, a lot of that chest thumping, a lot of this drum beating is, you know, driven by, hey, we should be spending more money on guns and bombs and blowing things up than, you know, feeding kids and building bridges?
When it was debated, Rick, about the fact that, you know, those planes headed to D.C. 2001, September the 11th, that those should have been shot down, and they weren't shot down because some planes closer to D.C. weren't armed at the Air Force base. The members of Congress, who were from war districts, I call them, you know, where there are defense contracts, stood up and said, we need to beef up the military. What, to create a plane that we shoot down other planes over cities? I mean, really, that was the drumbeat. When we had the anthrax, for some reason, we had to build up the military. They invade the Crimea, and we have to build up the military. The Iranians sit down with us at the table to talk about containing nukes, and we have to build up the military. You know, so it's just constant, and it's about money, and it's about defense contractors, and any good military emergency will not be left sitting there alone.
Yeah, I mean, and there's, because there's profit to be made. And you go back and you read Smedley Butler's piece back from the 30s, War is a Racket. Is it much of a racket now as it was then? Probably even more so today than back then.
And it's a more sophisticated one now, and they reach out, you know, it's the jobs, and they have to do this, and then this type of device and weaponry. And, of course, we have to have military readiness. I think everybody understands that. But as far as the, you know, the nuke race that we were into, you know, you see one nuclear war, you've seen them all.
Yeah.
You know, if we have 5,000 left, that's plenty to wipe the Earth out multiple times. So, but there are people out there that really cater to this. I used to call it the toys.
Yeah.
They would come up with all these ideas of what I call the military toys.
You need them. You need to have toys.
Military.
You know, we're just bigger kids with bigger toys. And, you know, the thing that gets me is you go back and you look at this, and I'm not against building toys if we're taking care of everything else.
Well, the argument they will make is we can't take care of everything else till we're strong in defense, but there's a limit as to how much, and we could just keep going with defense to build and build and build and have, you know, stockpiles of this and stockpiles of that. I mean, when do you stop?
Now, and that's the question. I mean, because we're hearing a lot of this stuff now, Bob, of, you know, are we right back in the Cold War? And even I asked the question, is this going to get us back to that Cold War era? Because I asked this question months ago about what was going on in Ukraine. Because it looked to me, you know, growing up during that time period, same as you. You saw what would go on with these intermediary countries where the U.S. or the Soviets would push and pull and use that as the chessboard to play their little power game.
Sure.
And I said, you know, it just reminds me of being a kid again. Are we going to see this more often? And everyone told me, no, this is much too small for that. Well, here we are.
Well, yes, this could escalate into a very, very bad situation where we actually, you know, do get into this whole Cold War, this war of chest thumping, and then the military buildup and the preparation, you know, and they're going to come get us, and we have to do this and do that. It would be disastrous to get back to the Cold War.
Yep.
Now, I realize right now, President Obama, if he dares to extend a hand out there to communicate, you know, it's going to get chopped off, you know, all over the place. I understand that he'll be, quote, weak, not the macho guy, you know.
No, he's not going to even come back with a stump on the end of his arm.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, here's the other thing. Did the Russians shoot down the plane over Malaysia? Obama did it, right?
Well, they had, you know, they... A guy on Fox, I'll just put it that way, is not to give him publicity. A guy on Fox insinuated, you know, there were two Iranians on the airplane. You know, they were escaping Iran. Yes, they were. There were two Iranians on the airplane escaping. But all of a sudden it was, you know, insinuated, well, Iran, and the president's been dealing with Iran, and people were calling in saying, you see, we're weak. Iran knows it. You know, that whole thing was beginning. Anything they can find, they'll try to utilize.
Yeah, so what's going on with this? Have they figured out? I know they found some oil slicks. There's a possibility the plane made a U-turn. How come they can't, big 777s just don't fall out of the sky? Where'd it go?
You know, it's such a mystery that they know it made a U-turn, and they know the transponder stopped working, which is kind of instant destruction. So you can only speculate that something went wrong in the system of the plane, or it was blown up by somebody.
Yeah.
But something went wrong in the system, and it just blew up in small pieces and then scattered all over the ocean. Because one would think if it fell, they have gliding speeds where they fall, they glide, they fall, they glide, which is what the pilots would do. If that happened, one would think that there'd be a lot of huge debris that immediately was available for sight, you know, if it crashed that way.
Right. Do you think we're ever going to figure this out, or will this just be a mystery?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would assume they're going to find it, but, you know, it's just it's a strange one, the way it vanished.
Let's get to some real fireworks today. I guess Feinstein was taken on the CIA for spying, I guess, on her, maybe? Her office? What?
Well, there are congressional computers, and then there was a special system created, which is outside the box because it's the Senate Intelligence Committee that Senator Feinstein chairs, and that is secretive even from other members, you know, for a lot of items. And so there was a separate computer system, a mini system, let me say, created so that the staffers, per a previous agreement, could get millions of documents and use this scanner process with the CIA's documents because they were looking at interrogation practices, who knew what, et cetera. Now, this dates back to Alice Fisher and Alberto Gonzalez and, you know, these people that Alice Fisher was in the Justice Department, tried to cover up when the FBI said there was torture, interrogation going on. You know, this goes way back to Bush. But they were looking at, you know, what we were doing. And as they scanned and put the documents, they found certain things in the documents, the Senate staffers did. Now, the CIA, this is what Senator Feinstein is not speculating, this is what she has said, that the CIA got into the system and then took away what the Senate staffers found out, basically. I'm not being very high-tech in my answer, but that's what they did. CIA says, no, we didn't do it with Brennan, although maybe it was done and he didn't know it. But here's the point of this whole thing. This is Senator Dianne Feinstein. This is a long-term member of the Senate, you know, not known for any flippant type of behavior, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who would, I don't think, would ruin her reputation by making a statement that they did this if she did it based on, you know, a whim.
Right.
And it's been turned over by the Inspector General for the CIA, has turned it over to the Justice Department. So there was enough for him to do that. Something's not right here, and I'm telling you, if the CIA did this, and now they've denied it, there will be Congress will win on this. There'll be a war with the CIA.
Absolutely.